Good morning. I'm calling the House Energy Policy Committee to order. There's two things about the room I want to tell you. One, it's a little smaller than we would have liked, and we are working on getting a bigger room over in the state office building. We will go from 9 until about 10 or 10:30, and then we will recess for 15 minutes and take a break. Hopefully, at that point, we will move over the state office building into a larger room. And the speakers in this room have a large amount of feedback that's really obnoxious. So we are not going to be using the speakers. We're using the microphone, so we're recording today's hearing. So members that speak into the microphones will be recorded. But we will have to speak loud so that the observers can hear us. So this morning we're here to hear House File 880. And Representative Hornstein is going to present the bill. We will take testifiers. Those in favor of the bill and those opposed in alternating order until we've concluded the testimony on the bill, and then we will move to amendments, if any, at that point. So with that, good morning, Representative Hornstein.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Tell us about your bill.
Thanks for hearing House File 880, Madam Chair, member. We are advancing this bill to acknowledge, I think, some fundamental realities that are taking place in the energy sector since the last renewable energy standard was passed by the legislature. Our electric system is fundamentally changing, and the question for us is, do we want Minnesota to take a greater advantage of these changes? We have come a long way since 2007, and I think some of the members of this committee were here when we passed that renewable energy standard. Some were not. And our Next Generation Act, that's what it was called, the Next Generation Energy Act, we have now 17% of Minnesota's energy coming from renewables in just 5 short years. In 2006, this number was approximately 5%. So, Madam Chair and members, we can see that this policy has had tremendous impact, tremendous positive impact in a very short amount of time. Our electric utilities in the state have done a great job of integrating wind energy into the grid and have shown with their own filings that wind has been very good for electricity customers. And we had testimony last week indicating that. Mr. Evans from Xcel had a very strong endorsement of wind in the testimony he gave before this committee. Our utilities are either meeting or exceeding their requirements, and House File 880 ensures that we keep up the momentum. So if I were to describe this in just one phrase, this House File, it would be building on our success. We're building on our success as a state in terms of leading the way on renewables. And so, Madam Chair, this bill takes our original 25% renewable energy standard by 2025 and builds on to that. It builds on to the success of that. We keep the definitions and large structure of the standard in place, but we propose increasing the renewable mandate to 40% by 2030. This gives electric utilities 17 years to go from the current 17% to 40% by 2030. 17 years. I think that's a quite reasonable and even somewhat conservative standard to reach. But we want to make sure that, again, we build on our success and we're able to give all of the stakeholders the time it takes to reach this standard. But I think it's very reasonable, and we're giving the proper time to make sure this infrastructure is built and implemented. And that's why 40% by 2030 is achievable. Our current standard is 30% by 2020 for Xcel, our largest utility, and 25% for everyone else. So in conclusion, Madam Chair, before I hand this over to Mr. Sullivan, who will go through the technical aspects of the bill, this legislation supports and builds on the strong foundation of skilled wind jobs. This is a jobs bill. And it's already, that we already have in Minnesota. It provides long-term, affordable, reliable electricity rates, brings millions in investment and tax revenues, and ensures that Minnesota continues moving towards a more sustainable and less carbon-intensive energy future. And my last comment, Madam Chair, on this one is that in these last years since our 6 years since our renewable energy standard was passed, we've gone the other direction on in terms of really addressing globally the threat of climate change. We've seen already more and more evidence, and Mr. Steger will talk about this, of growing melting, some severity in weather, storms. This is real. It's happening. It can't be denied. And so this is a very, very important step for Minnesota to take in addressing climate change. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll just have Mr. Sullivan from Wind on the Wires go through some of the more technical aspects of the bill. But the key provision, Madam Chair, is 40% by 2030.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Mr. Sullivan, please introduce yourself and say who you're with for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Sullivan. I'm the Regional Policy Manager for Wind on the Wires. Wind on the Wires is a nonprofit organization. Our members are the large wind developers, manufacturers, and then also the environmental advocacy community. So we see our role to be basically the hub that kind of fits together the larger wind industry and renewables industry. So I think where I'd like to start my testimony is to kind of take a step back and highlight some of what Representative Hornstein had mentioned. And to start with the fact that the electric system is fundamentally changing, and as the system has moved away from balkanized, smaller service territories, and moved towards the development of large regional grids like MISO, ERCOT, larger ISOs is the phrase. What this has done is it has reduced basically the one fundamental that we've talked about for a long time, we still talk about it, which is the necessity for the baseload power plant. And in fact, with the large regional grid where you have literally thousands of generators feeding into and dropping off of over the course of a day, the large baseload facility, it's simply becoming obsolete for economic reasons. And some of the testifiers that you'll hear later today will talk more about that. But in Minnesota, what we found with MISO is this exact same thing, is that we're becoming less reliant on these fixed baseload generators. And in this paradigm, in this new industry, smaller and more flexible, less expensive generators are favored. So This and what we're seeing is renewables and natural gas being the favored alternatives. So I guess one of the points that I'd like to stress is this fundamental change is happening now. There's nothing that can be done to stop it. But what Minnesota can do is Minnesota and policymakers can make the decision, does Minnesota want to take greater advantage of this by enacting higher RES requirements? Because a smaller, more flexible, I wouldn't say smaller, but a more flexible system, one that is less reliant on fixed generators, does not necessarily have to be a cleaner system. And what Minnesota is deciding by enacting a higher RES, a 40% by 30, Minnesota is placing a preference on clean, renewable generators that primarily have jobs here in Minnesota as opposed to jobs elsewhere. So with that as kind of the 10,000-foot what's happening, I'll focus in on the key provisions of the legislation. So as Representative Hornstein said, that really the big high, highline issue is the 40% RES by 2030. And we think that the reasons that this is necessary are it will send the signal to Minnesota, to industry, to the renewables industry, that Minnesota wants its retiring fleet, its legacy fleet that is dropping off over the course of the next decade and two decades, that we want a very high percentage of that to be clean, renewable generation. And it also, it sets the stage for a stable market for renewables in Minnesota for decades. This is, it's very important because when you look at the way the industry grows, it's blocky. And what we see is that, you know, when incentives drop off, things come down. So what we would like to see is we'd like to see a more stable ramp up. And then a higher res out to 2030 is really setting the stage for that more consistent ramp up. The bill also does make some changes to the current renewable energy standard. The main change that it does, which you'll hear a lot about today, is that it prospectively, the language is not clear in the bill right now, and we intend to change that, but prospectively, it shortens the time for renewable energy credit or renewable energy certificate banking. Right now, utilities are allowed to bank credits for 4 years, and they can use these credits for compliance with the RES, and it drops that down to 1 year. And again, this change is not going to be retroactive. It is prospective. And we feel that the reason that that's necessary is that the current REC bank with a longer time basically manipulates the market and it that utilities, they don't have to build as consistently to meet the requirements. Again, kind of getting to that blocky nature of the ramp up. And we would like to see that change where utilities are building more consistently, where there's kind of the natural hedging is built into the ramp up, which we think would be better for ratepayers. We'd like to see some changes there. The bill also pushes the timetables up for non-XL utilities. You know, the reason that we think that this is necessary is again to take advantage of the historic build-out of transmission that's occurring right now. The historically low prices that we're seeing in the MISO market right now could be locked in for many years if the build-out is ramped up in the near term. Right now in the MISO market, we have energy prices are quite low. One of the great benefits of a wind contract is that you can buy them for 20-year or 30-year increments and lock in that price, from 1998 through to 2018, or from today, 2013, you can lock that in until 2033. So what we'd like to see is to take more advantage of that opportunity right now, and a faster build-out now encourages that. Another important aspect to this is that, and I mentioned it a little bit earlier, but that as coal and legacy facilities drop off, a higher res basically locks in the movement, the transition to renewables, to prevent a flight to another alternative. And then the last change to the current renewable energy standard that we're proposing, which is actually, we feel quite important, but maybe kind of sailing under the radar a little bit, is it does remove the certificate of need for wind and solar projects. Right now, wind and solar, but primarily wind, has a limited exemption for a certificate of need. If you're building in Minnesota to meet the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard, you get exempted. The idea being, the standard sets the need. You know, you don't the RES says, you know, we need the energy, so you don't need to go through an entire certificate of need process. But what developers would like to do, sorry, my iPhone and iPad are in sync. So, we would like to do is. Developers in MISO, one of the great benefits of being in MISO is that if somebody, you can buy anywhere in MISO, you can contract with anybody in MISO. So if you want to build in Minnesota to contract with a load in Indiana, you can do that. But under Minnesota's current law, Minnesota sets up basically what we refer to as a mini certificate of need. What in practice happens, the developers, they don't know what a mini certificate of need is. No one has ever gone through the procedure as far as I'm aware. And it creates uncertainty for the developers. They end up doing a full-blown certificate of need. And that's not cheap. And it's certain you know what the prices are going to be, but it's not inexpensive. We would like to see that removed so that when an Iberdrola, Geronimo, an EDF, or one of the developers is building in Minnesota for load somewhere else, they do not have to go through a certificate of need procedure. And an important element with this is that, you know, environmental review is not impacted. Environmental review is all still required under permitting and siting, and the environmental advocacy organizations, we've worked with them, and they're at a place of they're comfortable with the language as it is now, provided it's limited simply to renewable generators. I think that the key takeaway from this provision is that if you want more renewables throughout the system, then this is a way to get them kind of on the softer side. And then the last provision of the bill, it creates a solar standard, and much like the governor's bill, we don't put actual numbers into our solar standard, but we do think that solar is an important piece of the energy system. There's a value to solar, it's quantifiable, and we would like to see the market for solar get built. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from members for Representative Hornstein or Mr. Sullivan at this point? Representative Scott.
Thank you. And either one of you can answer this, I guess, but if we get 17 years down the road and the levels of CO2 haven't changed and your so-called man-made climate change hasn't been affected, what then?
Representative Hornstein or Mr. Sullivan?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. I would take strong issue with calling climate change so-called.
I said man-made.
Okay. It is, and you know, we have to be very cognizant that while we are looking at a much broader global issue, it's incumbent on everybody to do their share to reduce climate change. So I would address that, Representative Scott, by saying we can be an example. If we have a 40% renewable standard, that sends a message not only to the rest of the United States, which is the largest carbon producer, but it also sends a global message, just as Germany has done with their 80% standard. So I'm confident, Madam Chair and Representative Scott, that if we're able to implement this, not only will we be doing our share in Minnesota, we'll be sending our message globally. And I'll tell you, if we haven't addressed this climate issue and we're not seeing carbon go down significantly by 2040, we're in big trouble.
I guess the way that I would address that issue is maybe by taking a pass on the more, you know, whether or not we can change climate change or not, which I know is happening. It's not actually up for dispute. But there are reasons to do this other than climate change. There are 3,000 jobs in Minnesota right now. Many of these folks in this room are benefiting greatly from those jobs, and we need to maintain this industry in the same way that we maintain other Minnesota industries. We need to encourage the growth of this industry in the same way that we encourage other Minnesota industries. And I would also add that, and I have handouts that we've prepared, that this is good for ratepayers. Minnesota ratepayers have benefited greatly. You know, the utilities, as they've reported, that this has been a benefit. It has reduced electric rates in many cases. It's held electric rates stable in many cases, and that on its own is a benefit. The Minnesota's Department of Commerce, the Division of Energy Resources, has recently said that it's cost effective. So I think there are many reasons to do it. And if in 2035 we look back and, you know, the planet is effectively, you know, we haven't changed. I mean, that would be a shame. But there are other benefits that this bill will deliver.
Representative Scott.
And so what you're saying is create new jobs to replace the ones that are going to be lost through putting coal plants and other electrical generation out of business. And then So if 40% isn't enough, and by 2035, I believe it is, do we then go up to 80? I mean, where is there a stopping point to this? I'll answer that first.
Sure.
Mr. Sullivan, to the point of the comparison between jobs in the wind industry and jobs in coal.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Scott. I mean, the point of this bill is not to put any other, you know, facility out of business. That's happening. You know, the coal facilities, large central station coal facilities, you know, these are legacy facilities. They're 50, 60, 70 years old. You know, the new ones are 30 years old. And, I mean, you know, I bought a new iPhone recently. It replaced my old iPhone. That's the same thing that's happening right now. And what the point of this legislation is that, I mean, you really get you get multiple benefits from it. You reduce CO2, which is very important, and that's why a number of people are here to speak on that. But you also do capture what is happening in the market at a greater level. You set Minnesota up to be more of a player in the renewable energy world than it already is, and it already is significant. You've got large companies that are in Minnesota that do a lot of business elsewhere. You know, because Minnesota's already enacted these standards.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Scott's point, and I'm not some crazy, wild-eyed, liberal, environmental, greeny kind of person, but I'd love to have it be 80 or 100% by 2030 or 2040. Because to the extent that we can manage to do that, and technology is such, just the you referenced your iPhone syncing with your iPad and all these things that maybe the technology will allow us to get there by then. But I'm also kind of practical and prudent in the off-ramps, gentlemen. Number one, is there any change in the off-ramps if it becomes uneconomical, if it results in significant increases? And then number two is I looked quickly through the bill, but how would that actually take place? Is there an application process that, can you kind of walk me through, number one, that there's no change in the off-ramps, sure. And number two, how it would occur?
Sure.
Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Atkins. That's right. There are no changes in the off-ramps. The off-ramps remain the same. So if an electric utility or a large user wants to petition because their rates have gone up and they believe that it's because of renewables, you know, they can have the Public Utilities Commission, if the facts show it, that renewables are the driver of the electric rate increase, they can have the Public Utilities Commission basically suspend the standard for that particular electric utility. That is unchanged.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you. And to date, have we seen that? And I'd ask, eventually I think we'll have some of the utilities come up and share the same, but has there been any evidence of that reported? Obviously we've been implementing some of that already. Any indication of that move in the direction of uneconomical increases?
Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and Representative Atkins, there has not. There have been no off-ramps requested and therefore none granted. And if a utility has a legitimate argument that a renewable is increased, you know, they should take it to the Public Utilities Commission.
Thank you.
But that has not happened.
Thank you. And we will have more discussion wrap up. But let's move to testimony. Our first testifier is Will Steger from the Will Steger Foundation. Good morning, Mr. Steger. Welcome to the committee. We're honored to have you. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Will Steger, Will Steger Foundation, and Madam Chair and members of the committee, I want to appreciate the opportunity here to speak today. Last 4 or 5 years, I've traveled around Minnesota presenting interviews, answering questions. I literally spoke to tens of thousands of Minnesotans. And I have a pretty good cross-section of urban and rural, conservative, liberals, and pretty good pulse. And overwhelming I find an overwhelming support for clean energy, and also the need for our elected officials to take action in that direction. I also, in the last 2-3 years, traveled around defending the EPA, the carbon dioxide rules, and I was very interested in the concern that I found in America, in the Minnesota people, for coal, for health hazards, for the mercury, emphysema, and the true costs of coal, both health and also climate. And my real expertise is probably traveling in the polar regions. I've traveled for over 50 years in these regions, and I've become an eyewitness for the changes of climate change or global warming. And I want to talk about a few of these. I realize the science around climate change can be a little confusing, and it's possible to change these facts around and really confuse the public, but the reality of what's happening you can't really dispute. We have what is called ice shelves. These are huge slabs of ice, 1,000 feet thick, that attach themselves to Antarctica and the northern polar regions. These ice shelves were laid down in the last ice age, 7 to 12,000 years ago, so these have survived really a lot of variation in the climate. But every ice shelf that I've traveled on in my career is disintegrated. For example, 11 years ago, or 20 years ago, I crossed the Larsen Ice Shelf in Antarctica, and this is 300 miles across. It's like traveling from International Falls to Austin, Minnesota. It took us 30 days to cross that. This was 22 years ago. In 2002, around this time, I was reading the Minneapolis Tribune, turned to page 9 or 10, headline saying, Larsen B Ice Shelf disintegrates. This whole ice shelf, in a matter of 4 weeks, disintegrated. And every ice shelf, as I mentioned, that I've traveled on and walked on, is all now open water. And to get a sense of that, it's just incredible to travel this long distances. Even more alarming is the sea ice. The sea ice is the thin layer of ice on the Arctic Ocean. The Arctic Ocean is the size of the United States and Mexico combined. That used to be covered by about a 12-foot average of ice. Even in the summer, 95% of that ice was still around. And as you may be aware of, in the polar regions, you have 24-hour sun for 5 months. And that's a lot of solar radiation that used to strike that ice in the summer and reflect off into outer space, which kept our climate cool. It was like a thermostat. We had an excess amount of energy coming in the equatorial areas, negative energy in the polar areas, and this heat balance is done by, of course, ocean currents and weather currents. And I saw, starting in 1990, this ice, sea ice starting to break up. 2007, by huge alarm, even conservative scientists, liberal scientists, 2007, 50% of the sea ice broke up. And last year, two-thirds of it was gone in the summertime. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means this huge area, the size of the United States, that used to be ice and reflected, is now absorbing energy in the darker water surfaces. For the first time in the last couple of years, we have more energy being absorbed into our climate than what's being given off. And then Greenland ice cap, I'll conclude it, I crossed Greenland a couple times. In 08, we kite-skied in the summertime to check out the thawing levels. At that time, we were up at 8,000 feet. Well, last year, 2012, in the summer, Greenland had thawing right to the very top of the ice cap, 10,200 feet. And 2012 was a record hot year all around the globe, this state, United States, globally. And 2012, I'm afraid, is going to go down in history as the year that we lost the Arctic environment, because that is not going to come back. I don't have to talk too much now about the extremes in the Arctic, because we now are seeing the extremes here in Minnesota. It's pretty obvious. I was in New Ulm and Wilmer, the rural areas there, of the drought, dry soils goes down 6 to 8 feet of dry soil. Farmers are very concerned. Ely, Minnesota, huge fires. Last May, we had a fire that almost took out the southern part of our little town, which is Ely is the fire suppression capital of northeastern Minnesota. Part of that almost burnt down. I was there. I saw it. 10 days later, we have this massive flood in, that we're still paying for. We paid, what, $140 million for that in June in Duluth? So as we emit more and more carbon dioxide, the weather, the climate is starting to go out of control. And this is the reality of it. We have to look beyond our self-interest on this. We have to be responsible. We have to look at the children and the future generations. I had a number of discussions with the governor before the State of the State regarding the climate and clean energy. His pollsters were telling him not to talk about climate. He decided to talk about climate. And I told him, well, that's courageous. And he said, no, it's not courageous. It's the right thing to do. And I think in Minnesota here, we have to make the right steps here. We have to move away from coal as quickly as possible. We have to create more jobs through renewables. It's 40% on wind, solar, biomass. We need a shot to the moon here. We need to come together on, around the state here to create these new jobs and to debate this climate problem that we're having for the sake of our children. So I want to thank you for the time here today to present.
Thank you for coming. My my daughter Sophie went with me to the governor's State of the State, and I asked her after he finished delivering it what she thought of it. And she said, well, there was so much for young people. I was astonished because I thought she'd be bored. And one of the things she cited was what the governor said about clean energy.
Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Steger? Representative Mazin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Steger, I remember when you came to Egan, I think it was in 2005, and showed some of your photos of some of the melting at that point.
Yeah.
And then I was at your presentation at the zoo school last fall.
Okay.
And again, just looking at your photos and seeing the dramatic changes has been incredible. And I just appreciate all the work that you're doing.
Thank you, Representative.
Trying to help us with this situation.
Thank you.
Other member questions for Mr. Steger? Thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
The next testifier is Daryl Tveitbach from Northern Municipal Power Agency. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you're with for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Daryl Tveitbach. I am the general manager of the Northern Municipal Power Agency, which is headquartered in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. We serve the needs of 10 municipal electric utilities in northwestern Minnesota as well as several in eastern North Dakota. We were the first joint action agency formed in Minnesota in 1976. In 1981, we formed a partnership with the Minn Kota Power Cooperative, purchasing 15% of their transmission system and a 30% interest in the Coyote Station at Beulah, North Dakota. Minn Kota serves as our operating agent. Together, we refer to ourselves as the joint system in our family. NMPA's resources and Minn Kota's are operated as one system, and the pooling of these resources serves the electric needs of 12 municipal utilities and 11 cooperative utilities, all residing in the same geographical area of eastern North Dakota and northwestern Minnesota. Together, we serve about 135,000 customers in that region. Following the enactment of the 2007 Next Generation Energy legislation, we began considering how we would meet the mandate of the 25% RES. At that time, we were experiencing growth of 2.5% to 3% per year as a joint system. It appeared that we would be in need of additional energy and capacity in the not-too-distant future. Through the RFP process, we were able to secure wind energy purchase power agreements at very near the current MISO price and for a contract term of 20 years. At that time, given the information we knew over a period of three years, we entered into contracts that allowed us to meet the 2007 legislation early. We have met the current RES for renewables And if you add in some additional hydropower that is part of the Western system, we're well above that current requirement. Asking our ratepayers to do more will have serious consequences, in our opinion. Given the effects of the recession, causing a flattening of growth from 1 to 1.5%, and a reduction in the power market prices that everyone has experienced, our renewable portfolio is causing us an additional $25 million a year in expense at this time. Given that we have met the current mandate, the proposed solar mandate, and an increase in the RPS to 40% as proposed in this bill, our member ratepayers cannot bear the additional cost. Adding additional energy mandates will only make energy more expensive to our members and customers. These proposals, it appears, may cause as much as a 70% increase in our wholesale rates over time, and consequently a similar increase on the retail level. I'm greatly concerned about how Northwestern Minnesota's industrial, commercial, and residential customers will react if this proposal becomes law. I would be happy to answer any questions the members may have.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm going to try to get your name correct. Is Mr. Tweitbach or Tweitbach?
Norwegians pronounce their V's like W's, so it comes out Tweitbach.
Tweitbach.
We all know Tom Bach, so that part should be easy.
Sure.
I think he's a Norwegian, too.
Sure. Well, thank you. I have two questions. The first, I know we're often told about how expensive renewables are, and oftentimes there's a particular Minn Kota project that's cited as the example of why it's too expensive, but when you look at aggregately the number of contracts and the price of a lot of those contracts, they're oftentimes a lot less than that one that really is talked about is driving the price. So is that reflective of the whole market, or is it just maybe a bad business decision that was executed?
Mr. Tweitbach.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, in 2008 and 2009, when we made these decisions, we made them given the information we currently had at that time. I don't think we or anyone were probably able to see the depth of the recession that we had and the reduction in the need for capacity and energy in the MISO market, which is what has driven the price down. And I think in the long term, or at least in the near term, we think the market in MISO will probably stay at about that 2 to 3 cent range for a little while. So we'll face this problem for some time to come.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. And I do think that, I mean, there's at least one project that I think often gives a black eye to a lot of other good projects just because the prices were executed at the very top of the market, and then we did, you know, I think there were maybe some alternatives there. The other question I have, and I think this is kind of the heart of the matter, is I acknowledge that we have to address climate change, and I'm looking for solutions, and if you have solutions, I'm willing to hear what they are, because what we're doing right now is not sustainable. So do you have ideas or plans if this is not the direction that you would like to go? What would be a proposed solution?
Mr. Tweitbach.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, I think currently I can't think of any other real solutions currently, but I do believe that in the future, we have to put some money into research to find those solutions. I don't think we should totally rule out fossil fuel going forward. I don't see how we can. But we can maybe do something with it if we try. We have a lot of smart people in the world that can figure these things out.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned a 70% increase in wholesale rates that this could cost your customers. Can you tell me, maybe you have an idea, maybe you don't, what the average household income of your service members is? Mr. Tweitbach.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I believe I can speak for the community that I live in. I don't know all the numbers off the top of my head because it's a pretty big geographical area. In the community I live in, Thief River Falls, the mean income in the last census was about $37,000. And I think that's quite a bit less than the state mean, which I think is in the 70s. That's just off the top of my head. The reason I believe for that is that the communities in that part of the state, and maybe not unlike a lot of communities, there's an awful lot of folks on fixed income.
Representative Scott.
That's all. Thank you.
Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Teutbach. And I'm not trying to make this a pointed issue for you or embarrass you in any. I will tell you what I'm reading. There's a fact sheet that was passed out by Wind on the Wires, who are obviously the proponents of the bill. It's a summary of the utility compliance reports from the PUC's docket 11-852. As I read it rapidly, you guys represent a 15.81% figure. Not vast majority, everybody else has a very minimal impact as a result of the RES. I think Representative Falk alluded to it. I just don't know what's going on. Why are you guys so significantly out of line with what others have been reporting?
Mr. Teutbach.
Madam Chair and Representative Falk, or Atkins, I'm sorry.
I appreciate the compliment.
I don't.
Maybe I shouldn't even answer the question then. I don't know. No, seriously, during the course of a year on an annual basis, the wind that we have, and we have quite a bit, generates more energy than we really need in our system, so it has to be dumped into MISO. And in those hours of the day, it's at a pretty substantial loss. We have to take and pay for whatever is delivered by the owners of those projects under contract. And we have to pay a guaranteed price to them. And often during many hours of the year, the MISO prices are much lower than the price we're paying. That's causing the deficit that we see.
And
Representative
just
Atkins.
To follow up, Mr. Teutbach, there was a reference, though, and I've heard it from others before we came into this meeting, about a decision that you folks made in the mid-2000s or late 2000s at the height of the market. Can you explain what that reference is to?
Mr. Teutbach.
Not specifically, no. What I can say is that at the time we were in the market for additional energy, we also had another coal-fired power plant on the drawing board, and we did decide not to build it because we were able to get the contracts that we were able to get.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further thoughts? Okay, members, at this time what we're going to do is we are going to take a 15-minute recess, and we have a better room in the state office building. We have room 10 in the state office building. For people who aren't as familiar with the Capitol, you go down to the basement level. There's a tunnel to the state office building, and we will reconvene at 10 o'clock a.m. in room 10.
Take our stuff with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Members, we're in recess. The House Policy Committee will come out of recess and back into session. The next testifier on the list is the Reverend Mark Peters. And it looks like people are more comfortable, and I think the sound system is better, so thank you for being willing to come on over to the State Office Building. Reverend Peters, please introduce yourself and state who you're with for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, all those gathered here today, my name is Mark Peters. Since 1995, I have served as Executive Director of the Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota. We're a partnership ministry of the six Minnesota synods of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the ELCA. There are over 1,200 congregations that are part of our network and 800,000 members throughout Minnesota. The moral call to move clean and efficient energy is not a new issue for our denomination. 20 years ago, in 1993, the ELCA voted overwhelming to support a social statement, Caring for Creation, Vision, Hope, and Justice. This states in part, the ELCA recognizes that the threat of dangerous global warming caused by the buildup of greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide, poses the challenges to the entire world and commits us as individuals, as a worship community, and as a public church to address this serious threat to God's creation. That's 1993. As we have heard already, House File 880 is a bold 40% renewable energy standard. It's good for our economy. This is responsible stewardship of God's creation. This is the next generation of energy generation for my two sons, who are 8 and 12 years old. They're out of school today. They understand the rudimentary principle of leaving their campsite in better shape than they found it. That's what I grew up with. It's part of my values, but it's part of our Christian values as well. The policies decided in 2013 will affect the world that they inherit. The status quo, tentative action, waiting for some future time, has enormous costs for the next generation. In 2007, Lutheran Coalition and Lutherans across the state joined us to play a key role in building remarkable bipartisan consensus for aggressive carbon reduction pollution goals and policies. This is living out our Christian vocation to be stewards of God's creation. Bishop John Anderson of southwestern Minnesota was appointed by Governor Tim Pawlenty to serve on the Minnesota Climate Advisory Group at the top level of deliberations of how to do this economically to serve us, our interests. I testified in 2007 for the renewable energy standard that is now we're seeking to improve, build on that success. I heard over and over during those hearings that this was going to cost us. We hear the same rhetoric today, this time around, and it rings hollow as the research dictates. The off-ramp is still there if it costs much. House file maintains that. Now is the time to look forward and build on this success. My kids and the world they inherit is being forged now today. Northeastern Minnesota Synod, their Bishop Tom Aiken, writing last year in the Metro Lutheran, stated, "Our synod has been very active in adopting resolutions about the care of creation." They've adopted five of them. I quote, "We have taken a biblical approach to this work and realized it is not wrong or political to focus on these issues. In doing so, we have taken care of creation out of the church's lost and found department. We have to find cleaner ways to take care of the earth and to sustain it for generations." He continues briefly, "Knowing this transition to clean energy will take time means that it is all the more important to start planning now for a clean energy future." He concludes, "Our church supports an orderly transition to cleaner energy." For 25 years, Lutheran Coalition has been proud to support Lutheran leaders and people of faith throughout Minnesota. We are not the only denomination that shares these strong social statements and principles calling for urgent action on these issues. In 2007, we were joined by many other faith partners, as we are today. Lutherans recognize that advocating for a clean energy future is rooted in the biblical mandate to care for creation. I'd like to conclude with this observation. And I'd say it's an honor to follow Will Steger. We worked with Will and our Minnesota bishops in the last 2 years, but actually since 2005, to host hearings, clean energy, climate, and health throughout Minnesota. And to give you a sense for the energy that we have in our denomination throughout the state, we had 400, let me just tally, we had clean energy and climate events. We had 400 people at Vinge Lutheran Church in Willmar. I moderated the community discussion. Bishop John Anderson was there speaking at the opening of that. He also spoke at St. Cloud at a Lutheran church. He spoke at New Ulm, where I'm going this weekend. He spoke, the bishop and their leader spoke in Princeton, at Lutheran churches, Grand Rapids, Baxter, and Moorhead at Concordia College. None of these events gathered less than 200 people. And in every instance, the deliberation and the community discussion was positive and urgent action. Thank you. I support this bill. I support that we move, get off the dime. It's not the time for timid action. Thank you very much. Any questions? I welcome them.
Thank you very much. Questions for members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, sir, just wondering, has your church also made preparations for if, you know, in the case of the previous testifier saying that the rates could go up 70%, we have people on fixed incomes and lower class people, what is the church doing to prepare to help the poor and make those increased energy costs?
The Lutheran Church has spoken out publicly both at the national and state level about the need for mitigation and adaptation, the need to already address the changes. You know, extreme weather is expensive weather, and it's costing our state a great deal already. And it's expensive. You know, there is in this particular bill, as there was in 2007, an off-ramp if the costs start going this way. And so that argument doesn't ring true. This to me is, and the research and the findings of the majority of the plants in Minnesota do not show this dramatic rate increase as a result of renewables. Plus, there is an urgency to deal with this for the health of our planet and for the next generations. That's how I would, and that's how our denomination approaches this issue.
Representative Scott,
there are 9 Synod resolutions in Minnesota from throughout the state addressing this issue,
and
calling for this action.
What's your denomination?
The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Further questions? Thank you, Reverend Peters. Our next testifier is Larry Johnston from Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency.
Hi, welcome. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Larry Johnston with Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. We're the wholesale supplier to 18 municipal utilities around the state of Minnesota, some of the larger outstate communities, Rochester, Austin, Owatonna. Actually, I have a couple observations from listening to the other testifiers, but there's two main points that I want to make with regard to the bill that give us concern. One is that we think that the bill has the cart before the horse, and I'll explain a little bit more what I mean with that. And then it makes a change to a significant component inside the existing RES that we think is one of the things that's made it successful. That we'd like to talk about as well. In terms of having the cart before the horse, you know, we heard a lot of the testifiers so far talk about building on the successes of the 2007 law. We think there's some very good reasons why that has gone the way it has. The 2007 law was a very deliberative, thoughtful, and studied process. Those of you who were around during that point in time recognize just exactly how much work went into that process. In 2005, the legislature actually commissioned a wind integration study that took the better part of 18 months that formulated the basis for us understanding some of the limitations and issues, including the cost, that needed to be dealt with in that process of moving that bill forward. I might suggest to you that the 100-page volume 1 conclusion of that study might be a great place for people to start in terms of if you're thinking about looking at changing standards, just to try to get a handle on the level and the various concerns that were out there. But I do want to quote specifically from that study just so you recognize the conclusion that came from that. And I quote, "The analytical results from this study show that the addition of wind generation to supply 20% of Minnesota retail electric energy sales can be reliably accommodated by the electric power system if sufficient transmission investments are made to support it." That study brought together known industry experts. It brought together a large cadre of utility individuals, wind developers, to try to get a good handle on exactly what that means. Now, this is kind of a sweeping change that, to some degree, depending upon what ultimately might happen with the addition of the solar standards, is essentially saying, let's increase these standards by 100%, when you recognize that the analysis is really predicated on adding 20% to the system. Why the cart before the horse? The bottom line here is, you know, we just think that it's appropriate to ask these questions ahead of time, get these issues thought through, get the results from MISO, get the impacts from MISO. I can tell you that across the MISO footprint, the MISO planning that has been done is all been predicated on the existing statutes in the states that we have. So, I mean, it would seem to me to be extremely prudent to get MISO's perspective on what sorts of impacts there might be with regard to this. You know, we hear a lot about the fact that the RES has been so horribly successful, albeit you've heard from several testifiers that there's some issues with that. I guess I would caution you that part of the reason I think it's worth asking these questions and getting some input is we talk like the RES has been achieved and we're there, and hasn't this all been quite simple to do. I might suggest to you that we're halfway through what the standard is, albeit most utilities are beyond that in their current portfolio at the moment. And we're currently trying to build some of that transmission. You're probably going to hear bills on that as well. All of that transmission's not in place at the moment. It's not always that easy to build either. So I just think these are prudent questions. Part of that success that, that people have talked about with the other bill was in understanding what it was happening, what was likely to happen before people move forward on that. I have one observation before I get to my last point. If I were to draw one conclusion, and maybe this is worth taking a look at, if I were to draw one conclusion from the studies that, that people have referenced in terms of the cost of the RES, much like other things in life, this is all about timing. If you were early on in putting wind on the system, not so much of a problem. If you were late to the game, if you were putting wind on the system in 2005 and 2006, you saw very different costs than you did if you started putting wind on the system in 2009 and 2010, given the changes in MISO. You know, there are still periods of time on our system where we incur negative locational marginal prices, LMPs, at nighttime, meaning that not only would we have to pay to produce the power, but if we intended to deliver that power, we would have to pay to deliver that power. You know, so there are still issues associated with this, and particularly in low load hours. And that was one of the main things that the wind integration studied. And so now to, again, kind of reference just doubling this, seems like these are things that we'd at least want to check. In our particular case, at Southern Minnesota Power, you know, it looked like about actually two things. One is when we did this looking across our integrated resource planning process from our 2009 IRP, at the end of the day, if we had the RES wind that we put in the system or we didn't, actual costs to us give a slight edge, roughly I think about $900,000 over a 15-year planning study, so basically even, to the wind, okay, gave a slight bump to the wind. But that was based on natural gas prices at $6.50 escalating forever. That's not, of course, the situation we find today. The other thing that we looked at was then, again, to try to balance a longer-term look, which we think is reasonable in kind of a planning model, any planning model, also recognizing you need to look at the short-term impacts. On our system, delivering our largest wind project, there's about $1 million to $1.5 million difference between what that project cost us on a monthly basis and what it's injected to MISO at. So, I mean, it's about, you know, a $12 million number on our system. That's probably about 5 to 6% of what system costs are on an annual basis. So, you know, a lot of this off-ramp talk depends on what it is you consider the egregious price to be. I know that in the case of Mr. Teitbach that you were talking to earlier, there was really no reason for them to approach the off-ramp because they had 20-year signed contracts in place to deliver everything they needed for the objective. So that's just something to keep in mind. My one other point that I want to make that's a change that I don't think is probably helpful to the RES, and that's the change in the renewable energy credits. I must admit I was happy to hear Mr. Sullivan, wherever, I don't know where Joe went, but he at least made me feel a lot better because in my read of the bill, I thought this was retrospective, not prospective. That makes me feel a little bit better, but I still think it's a real mistake to change the current structure of RECs being, if you will, having a shelf life of the year they're produced and then the subsequent four, to essentially the subsequent one. And I'll tell you why I think that's a mistake. One of the things historically that I think we got wrong in the process with the REO, which was, of course, the predecessor to the RES, was one of the things we got wrong is there was this simplistic assumption of developing of resources, whether they're conventional or not, that you could take a benchmark and you could increment at 1% annually. Well, that's not how anybody builds resources. And so when we had the long debate and studied things in 2007, we made the point that this investment is lumpy. You know, you need to be able to have the flexibility to be able to work to try to put together the best projects that you can to get the best cost, the best location, everything for your utility folks. Now, in doing that, we realize that makes it lumpy, and having the RECs to be able to either sell or bank to manage how you can put a project together gave you the flexibility to be able to do that. Interestingly enough, we hear from the proponents of this change that what that longer-term rec shelf life does is it creates a disadvantage for the industry in terms of highs and lows, if you will, like almost any industry, kind of a hog cycle for turbines, if you will. But frankly, when we overbuilt because we could put together the best package and get the best deal, and we bought more than we needed to have to meet our requirement, partly because we knew we had the ability to bank the RECs, I didn't hear anyone complaining about the fact that we built projects that were much larger than we needed. I think that's just part of it. A couple other important points with RECs that I don't want to lose sight of. That process created a REC market. The rest of the planet is trying to create REC markets, either statutorily or voluntary, to recognize that the marketplace can play a very valuable role in doing this. It, not only does it provide the flexibility for us to be able to meet the standard, but it provided an opportunity for developers of projects and owners of projects to be able to sell RECs, the environmental value, in locations where they likely would have never been able to get a physical delivery, because you separated those things. So it helped promote and prompt that renewable market, which is why people originally wanted to do that. I would hate to see that go away. It's really important in terms of doing that, and we would hate to see that lost in this particular process. We're as concerned about CO2 as the next person. I guess if I were contemplating making a change to RECs, maybe I would try to keep it more in line with the physics of the situation, and I would ask why there was a shelf life on RECs at all. And since as long as the renewable energy happens to produce, it produces so without a carbon footprint. That's a pretty radical statement. It's the opposite side of the 1 year, obviously. Maybe that means where we're currently at didn't hit such a bad balance. And with that, I'd take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Johnston, did your organization support the Renewable Energy Standard in 2007?
Mr. Johnston.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, ultimately, when we worked in the off-ramps, the answer to that is we did.
Representative Falk.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my recollection was a little bit different, that most utilities, still didn't support the bill at the end, but I could stand corrected there. Another question, how long do you predict natural gas prices will stay at this historic low or this depressed point?
Mr. Johnston.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, I guess the current phrase for things like that is that's significantly above my pay grade. If I could tell you that, I'd have Mr. Chu's position. am I someone who believes the Wall Street Journal and the industry's perspective that natural gas will be under $3, under $4 forever? No, I do not believe that. I can respond by saying, do I think it will hit the kind of $12 and $15 prices that we experienced in 2005? I also don't think that will be the case. I think we'll probably be much closer, longer term, to that $6 escalating at some level. But like I said, that natural gas hedging and forecasting is clearly not my forte.
Representative Falk.
And I guess kind of a final question then. I know you made the comment that you're as concerned about CO2 as the next person. If this is not the proposal and we've got the facts and evidence there that we have to address climate change, what is your proposal to meaningfully address this, realizing that we have a limited window to actually have a sustainable outcome?
Mr. Johnston.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, fair question. Actually, my passion and my love happens to be efficiency, and we'll do that to the greatest ability. But the main thing I have been speaking with regard to this bill is simply don't get the cart before the horse. I want the same deliberative consideration that was given to the 2007 piece of legislation. I just don't want people, moving halfway to our current objective, just assuming that you can double the amount of energy and capacity that you're going to deliver at certain points of the system without any potential consequences. I think we should understand that before we decide whether or not 30% is the right number, An additional 5% is the right number. Nothing is the right number. The only things that I have to guide me is that study that was done judiciously that suggested if we build the sort of transmission that we're attempting to build now, we should be able to reliably put 20% on the system.
Representative
Polk. Madam Chair, and I said last one's going to be the last one, but I do think we actually have some of that data. We did the wind integration study, yes, but we also did the sweet spot study, which for the most part has been left on the back burner, and that showed that we could add up to 1,200 megawatts of distributed generation at very low cost. And so to make the argument that we only have to rely upon the CapEx expansions and the transmission update and upgrades, I think doesn't take into account some of the data that we have that actually came from 2007, which my editorial comment, I don't think the utilities have actually picked up or run with. So I think that there's a huge opportunity there to add a significantly increased number of megawatts at very low cost, but it typically doesn't fit in the paradigm that utilities have often decided to work in.
Representative Falk, I'll ask the Duane Quam question, the Representative Quam question. Will you please forward the sweet spot study to all the members of the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe it would almost be easier for Mr. Eloff to send it around because he probably knows.
Okay, it already has been. Thank you. Mr. Johnston.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, my reaction to that would be I agree with what Mr. Sullivan said early on. The system that we're operating under today has changed significantly since we started debating the first of the RES standards back in 2005 with the development of the MISO market. My comment would be I would want to hear MISO's response to that.
Any follow-up?
No. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I agree that we have seen some changes, but in addition, the whole sweet spot study was, you know, looking at things basically below MISO's jurisdiction. We're looking at interconnecting at the lower voltages under the 100 kV lines as much as possible, which MISO doesn't see. And when they put their models together, they're looking at the 245 and the 230 and the 345s predominantly. And so a lot of that data, it hasn't necessarily changed because they weren't looking at it in the first place.
Mr. Johnston.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk. While that's true that they don't have jurisdiction, I would still ask MISO the question. It's still delivered to the system, and that's not to suggest that that delivery doesn't have an impact on the system. It's a jurisdictional question.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hornstein, in light of what he's said, and I don't know about the sweet spot today or whatever, but it does seem like we need to do kind of an apples-to-apples comparison of where we were in 2007 or whatever, whenever this was done. Is that something that you're open to doing before moving ahead? I just think with the magnitude of what this could mean, we certainly want to be cautious moving forward and make sure we have as much information as we can before we move forward.
Mr. Johnston.
That was...
Oh, it's for Representative Hornstein.
Yes, please. Thanks.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, we'll look at that study that Mr. Eloff has or will pass through the committee. Obviously, that's important. But one of the reasons that we have this very large time window is that, which is conservative. It's quite conservative to look at 17 years out from here. And I think so. We've built in, and then we have the off ramp. We have some of the concerns that Mr. Johnston mentioned about the credits and how those are prospectively. Addressed in this large timeline. So I think that we have been very careful in crafting this in terms of making sure that all the concerns that we're hearing today are raised. But obviously, a bill is a work in progress, and we'll be taking a look at some of these issues and being collaborative as we can with those opponents that are very interested and serious in moving forward on this.
Representative Scott. Members, a quorum is present, so at this point I would move that House File 880 be laid over for possible inclusion. We didn't actually move the bill until this point in the hearing. If there are no further questions for Mr. Johnston, I would like to go to the next testifier. Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier is Michael Noble. And after Michael Noble is John Brecky from Great River Energy.
Good morning, Mr. Noble. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Please state your name and who you're with and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, I'm Michael Noble. I'm the Executive Director of Fresh Energy. I'll keep my testimony very brief. Madam Chair, in the State of the State address, the Governor asked, are we doing all we can? And I think the answer is quite simple, that we are not. The Renewable Energy Standard is an elegant policy design that has worked exceedingly well. We brought approximately $10 billion of private capital investment in to serve Minnesota's electrical needs with no impact on electric rates for the most part. The proposed bill has us build on that success and take us to the next level where we would once again be the nation's leading state on renewable energy as we were in 2007. In the last 5 years, Minnesota's position has fallen from fourth in the nation on wind energy to seventh. And it's not because we don't have great engineers, it's not because we don't have great electric utilities, it's not because we don't have great wind developers, not because we don't have great farm country, great wind resources, it's because we're doing better on our policy than we thought we would do. We've got about 60 to 70% of the renewable energy under contract or in the ground that was called for in the 2007 statute. So this is the perfect opportunity to build on our success, use the simple policy mechanism that everybody agreed to and everybody supported in the 2007 legislature, and go to the next step. And with that, I conclude my testimony.
Questions for Mr. Noble? Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier is John Brecky from Great River Energy. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee about this proposed legislation. We are opposed to the legislation as it's drafted, and I'll talk today about some of the reasons why we are opposed to the legislation. And we'll talk about a new reason, a reason that might be new to many of you about why we are concerned on how this legislation positions the state of Minnesota in the wholesale energy market. And we think that the state ought to be mindful and strategic about how it positions itself in the wholesale energy market for the benefit of its consumers in the long term. And we'll come to that reason in a few minutes. We still have a long ways to go to meet the existing standard of 25% renewables by 2025. On Great River Energy's system, we serve 28 member cooperatives. We're not even halfway there in terms of how much wind we would need to build or acquire under contract to meet the standard. So we have a long ways to go. Most of my comments today will be with wind in mind, and that's because wind is the cheapest renewable energy option for utilities today. The reason it's so much cheaper than solar is because we pay about half the cost per kilowatt to install wind as what we do for solar, and we get about twice the amount of energy for the same number of kilowatts of capacity from wind than we do for solar. So we're taking less costs, we're dividing them over much more production, and we get, as a result, a less costly alternative by far than what we'd face with solar. And that's one of the reasons we're opposed to a solar energy standard that chooses a winner. Now we have a long ways to go to meet the standard as a winner. Now we have a long ways to go to meet the standard. A lot more wind that we need to add. We hope to work with a lot of the folks in this room to add that wind under the existing 25 by 25. So there's a lot of opportunities going forward. But to extend the standard right now, we don't think makes sense from the standpoint of resource plans within the state of Minnesota and utilities like Great River Energy, nor do we think it makes sense from the standpoint of our strategic position in the market. We're not growing in energy sales. We don't have new kilowatt hour sales of energy to spread the cost of these new resources over. So by adding these costs to the system, we're spreading it over the same number of sales, rates will go up. And nobody's really growing right now. Back when the 25 by 25 standard was passed, there was growth, and now there isn't. It makes it harder to cost effectively absorb the cost of new resources. We don't need them. We have enough resources to meet member needs through about 2030 without adding additional supplies. Now, we will add additional supplies before then because of the existing renewable energy standard. But when do we need energy the least economically in our portfolio? It's when it's windy outside. And I'll give you some evidence of that. In 2012, the average cost that we paid for wind energy in our system was $40 a megawatt hour. That's for the contracts that we have with wind developers, and it's a competitive price. They were all the result of RFPs that we did. We chose the competitive projects. We paid about $40 a megawatt hour for the average output. The market valued that energy at $14 a megawatt hour in 2012. The market didn't need it. Our coal facilities, and we'll talk about carbon in a minute, our coal facilities had more than twice the value per megawatt hour from the market than the wind did. What does this mean? This means that other states with less aggressive renewable energy standards, when it's windy outside, can buy energy for $14, and they don't have to pay the capital cost of the wind additions. Who pays the capital cost of the wind additions? Minnesotans. Minnesotans pay for it. They pay the $40. Market price goes to 14 because we're flooding the market with nice, low-cost wind energy that doesn't have a variable cost. You don't have to pay for the fuel. Wind is free, right? You just have to pay the capital cost. So we're filling the market with wind energy. It's dropping the price. On average, last year, $14. Other states can buy it, pass along savings to their consumers because they can back down coal plants, they can back down natural gas plants, and buy cheap energy on the market from Minnesotans who are paying the capital costs. And so strategically, the suggestion is that if we get too far out of whack with other states on a wind standard, what happens is an economic shift, that Minnesotans pay for the capital costs of those additions, there aren't any variable costs, and the benefits flow to other states and it makes us less competitive. That's a concern that we have. And it's corroborated by the prices that we're seeing in the market even last year with the wind that we have added. So the market values our coal energy at twice what it values wind because of time of day. It's produced at more valuable times of day. Now, there's been a lot of talk today about carbon reduction and taking carbon out of electricity production. One thing we'd like to point out is that it has become the law of the land for the United States Environmental Protection Agency to regulate carbon in the economy. EPA has issued an endangerment finding for greenhouse gas emissions. That endangerment finding has been upheld by the court system, and the EPA has a mandate to regulate carbon. They will act to remove carbon from the economy, from utilities, from transportation, from industry, and they're already starting to do so. We will face the repercussions of those actions. But to say today that we know that renewable energy is the cheapest way to take carbon out of the electric grid is a leap. We don't know that. There are lots of ways to take carbon out of electricity production. There's studies being done on carbon capture and sequestration. There's a possibility of different nuclear technologies. There's many different ways that we can look at to take carbon out of the electricity system. One way that's happening right now is a switch from coal into natural gas for energy production. It's happening already because of cheap natural gas prices. So there's lots of ways to reduce carbon from the electricity system. The EPA will regulate that. They've got a mandate to do so. For Minnesota to get ahead of it and choose renewable as the winner when something else might be cheaper is not doing a service to the people who pay the electric rates in Minnesota. Also, just want to mention about banking today. I agree with the comment that we'd be taking a big step backward by eliminating banking of renewable energy credits. We think it's been a great tool. It has accelerated wind development. And I know that wind developers are frustrated right now because there has been a lull, that utilities have a bank of RECs, and we don't need wind right now. And market prices have dropped, and that's helped drive this lull. But we did accelerate the addition of wind. And to just say that prospectively, RECs don't have a value beyond 1 year, it will slow down wind additions. It's counterproductive to the wind industry. If we can bank RECs and we know we can bank them, we will add wind earlier. We'll add more wind earlier because it has a value going forward. If we can't bank RECs, we'll add wind just in time to meet the mandate. We'll add it later. It'll slow down wind additions. So we think it makes much more sense to smooth it out, offer banking, and of all the things that we should agree on, we think we should agree on banking, that it has value, that it'll actually accelerate wind additions going forward. So in summary, we have concerns about the economic position that Minnesota will place itself in, is that if it chooses renewables as the way, the only way to decarbonify electricity production in the state, before we know that that is the best answer. We also are very concerned about choosing wind. You know, it's the cheapest option for renewables, but its value in the market is less than half of what coal output is. And yes, we've got to reduce emissions from coal, and EPA is going to mandate that. But we think that Minnesotans will pay the capital cost of these additions in their electric rates, and the benefits will flow to other states that can buy cheap energy at the time the wind is blowing. This doesn't position Minnesota well in the wholesale energy market, and we think that issue ought to be considered. Finally, we think solar energy is too expensive to carve out of an RES. It's far more expensive than wind energy. Its capital costs are more than twice that of wind. Its energy output is less than half that of wind. It's very expensive. For a 10% solar energy mandate, we're talking about a 40% rate increase from Great River Energy, just for 10% coming from solar. So we think the utilities should be able to choose the least cost renewable resource within the context of the existing RES and not have a chosen technology. Thank you for the time and appreciate your consideration.
Thank you. I have a question. You just indicated you believe there would be a 40% rate increase from solar. Can you walk us through the math?
We can provide a spreadsheet of our analysis on that, Madam Chair. The math is largely this. For a 10% solar mandate, GRE would have to invest $4 billion worth of new capital. So our assets would roughly double from what they are today. And it's so the math is driven by the ownership cost of, you know, servicing the debt and depreciating those assets over a 20-year time period. And we factored in the market value of the energy that is created by that solar, but it's not enough to offset the cost of the capital additions. So we'd have to pass through most of the costs in rates, and it's close to a 40% rate increase. You can prorate it from there. A 1% mandate, you know, is roughly a 4% rate increase.
It would be great if you could provide us with your presumption to get to your $4 billion number of what the cost of 1 megawatt of solar would cost the company.
We will, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. And then I have a question about natural gas prices. I was wondering how long in advance of the drop in natural gas prices did the utility industry predict the drop in natural gas prices?
You know, that's a great question. Every natural gas price forecast I've seen from experts in the industry over the last 10 years has been wrong. So I don't think the utility industry did see largely the drop in natural gas prices coming. I never saw a curve that had a drop off in natural gas prices. Now, there were some talking about fracking technology and the advancements in it and how much shale natural gas there was. There was even talk about how much shale oil there was in this country, but I don't think anybody saw the steep drop coming in terms of price, when it would come, and the magnitude.
If natural gas were to dramatically increase in price, how far in advance would you see that coming?
Again, every natural gas price forecast I've seen has been wrong, so we need to hedge ourselves against natural gas price shifts. The way we do that in our portfolio is we have resources that are diversified. So we have a combination of coal, natural gas, wind, and hydro, as well as RDF, refuse-derived fuel. So that's the way we're managing natural gas prices increases.
I think Minnesotans are also really interested in a diverse energy portfolio, and we're getting a lot of input from the public right now asking for solar. What percent of solar for a goal or a standard do you think is appropriate, and by what year?
We don't think any standard for solar is appropriate. Within the context of the renewable energy standard as it stands today, we think that renewable energy technologies ought to compete with each other for space within the context of contracts with utilities. When we issue RFPs for renewable energy, we don't exclude solar, we include it. We include biomass as well. So to have a separate carve-up for solar, we oppose it. We think there's some exciting things that can be done with distributed generation for solar, but it's for residents and businesses that want to invest in solar. And if they want to make that capital investment, we ought to have, you know, clear policies in place on how we deal with that in Minnesota. And so we're working with Mr. Grant and the state, the Dayton administration, on some ideas about that.
This is my last question, and then we have questions from members. You said that 10% is too aggressive for a solar standard. Would something like 1% by 2020 be achievable?
Madam Chair, we would not support a 1% solar energy standard. We think that there is room within the current 25 by 25 for solar to be considered by utilities. And we also think that there's opportunity for residents, homeowners, and you know, owners of businesses to consider adding solar, investing in that on a distributed generation basis. They've got that opportunity today if they wish to do it. There's policies to allow for that. So we would leave it at that. We oppose a solar energy standard in Minnesota due to costs.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a simple question about capital costs, but this is a fascinating discussion you're having with my friend Mr. Brecky. Just a comment on what can they make work. Ma'am, these people are the best in the world. They run the most fascinating machine. It's probably done more to improve the quality of our lives that's ever been invented, called the electrical grid. If we make a 90% solar mandate, they will make it work. The question is, why would we do that, and at what cost before we collapse the economy? I think that's the real question. These guys are engineers, and they're good at what they do. They can make anything work if we tell them what it is. But I understand the sense of, if we make up our minds on what the renewable portfolio number should be, let them do it at the lowest possible cost. That's where I think they're asking for some certainty. And even though I voted for that stupid bill a couple years ago, they have a mandate. They're trying to make it work. And now here we are monkeying with it again. I'm going to give you three quick examples of how this legislature has monkeyed with this stuff and what we've had to undo to undo it. When this all started with the cast storage back in the 90s, we actually put into law that XL Energy would sponsor and buy biomass, turkey litter, and a special kind of bush. That we actually were that prescriptive, that we wanted a renewable standard that included those three fuel sources. The turkey litter plant's up and running just because we can make it work, but we drove up the cost for the farmers in that area because they used to use the turkey litter for nitrogen-based fertilizer, and they got it for free. Now they're paying to haul fertilizer in for their fields, and the ratepayers at XL are paying to burn turkey litter, and they're paying a pretty good price, although that's classified information, we're told. The bush plant at the Laurentian project, we had to undo that whole thing and give it to the city so that they could replace their central heat plant, and we had to lift the bush mandate, tell them they could burn any woody biomass they could get their hands on. And then, of course, we have the St. Paul District Energy Plant, which is part of that deal. And again, that's classified information, and they're burning biomass there. Mr. Noble, now this is actually my comment and my question to future testifiers, because Mr. Brecky's company is not rate of return regulated. You're a cooperative, and your members pay whatever the cost is. And I will take exception with one thing you said, Mr. Brecky, $4 billion investment for solar. Most of that would be passed on to your ratepayers. I think all of it would be passed on to your ratepayers. Mr. Noble made a comment that one of the things we have done as a legislator is we've inspired $10 billion of new investment in renewable production in this state. I think that's a big number. I think it's high. But let's give them the benefit of the argument. One of the things we do through the Public Utility Commission is we compel anybody who wants to build generation in this state to make a case for a public certificate of need, because at the end of the day, the people who are captive to that company have to pay for the cost of the capital. Apparently, in 2005, before we did this, we had something along the lines of, help me if I'm missing the number, 15 to 18,000 megawatts of power in this state. I may be a little high on that. That's already bought and paid for and banked by the utilities and by their ratepayers. And now we've asked, the legislature, people to build another $10 billion on top of that. Who's paying for that, and where is that coming from? And that's the question I want to ask Mr. Alstrom from WindLogix, Mr. Frankel from Union Concerned Scientists, and maybe the people from Geronimo Energy. When we let the ratepayers pay for what's already out there and it's already working well, and now we've duplicated something over top of it, who gets to pay for that? Maybe that's the question going forward. I won't have to ask it every time. They can just make it part of their remarks.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Members, we have 30 testifiers. We are on number 7. We're almost two-thirds of the way through our time, and we are almost one-third of the way through our testifiers. So we're going to speed things up a little bit, and we're going to focus on questions and not observations, because when we debate an actual bill and we do and we vote on it, I think we're going to move to more of debating the policy.
Good.
And on both sides, I think we need to reel in the big philosophical debates and kind of focus in on the testifiers' information and ask them questions that are pertaining to the testimony that they delivered, so that we can hear from the people who took the time to come here this morning. We will be adjourning at noon, and that's when the hearing will end. So we want to get through absolutely as many people as possible. Representative Falk.
Yes.
Representative Beard.
This is a very big issue, Madam Chair. And may I suggest that if we're going to talk about turning the whole economy on its head, we allow more than 3 hours on one day to talk about this thing with people who are asking us to do that. Just an aside, housekeeping, I'm going to jump up and leave in just a minute. Don't take it personally. I have to touch the table in another committee we're expected to be at here this morning. I'll be right back, okay?
Yes, and that's, I'm glad you brought that up, Representative Beard, because many members are in other committees voting on bills, and that's why they're not here. This is taped, and so members can listen to it over the weekend. And Representative Beard, to the point of we need more than 3 hours to discuss this, believe me, we will be discussing it for more than 3 hours. On Monday, we'll be meeting from noon until 2 and 6 p.m. to midnight. And on Wednesday, we'll be meeting from 6 p.m. to midnight. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Brecky. Our next testifier is Mark Alstrom.
Madam Chair and members of the committee,
Mr. Alstrom, yes. I misspoke. On Monday, we are meeting 30 minutes after session ends, or 3:30. So we have 9 hours on Monday evening, potentially. Mr. Alstrom, go ahead. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the commission. My name is Mark Alstrom, and I'm the CEO of WinLogix in St. Paul. I've personally been involved with wind integration studies, going back to the 2003 Excel integration study, the 2006 Minnesota Wind Integration Study. More recently, I've been on technical review committees for most of the larger studies funded by the Department of Energy. I'm currently active with the Integrating Variable Generation Task Force for NERC, and I have written numerous articles about forecasting and integrating wind energy into power systems across the country, co-authored with staff from MISO and the other ISOs. Here in Minnesota, we have a long history of understanding wind energy and wind integration. We are further blessed by now being part of the MISO market, an independent system operator that's progressive and innovative in dealing with wind energy. My key point here today is that there have been major breakthroughs since 2007 that make it much easier to integrate renewables. MISO has publicly stated that they did not need to increase the regulation or reserves to integrate over 12,000 megawatts of wind energy that is currently on their system. In my conversations with them, they're confident that they can handle more wind in a reliable and efficient way. Let's talk very briefly about why they have this confidence. MISO and several other large system operators have largely eliminated the variability of wind by dispatching wind every 5 minutes, like they do with coal, natural gas, and other conventional generators. Every 5 minutes now, MISO is providing each wind plant with a set point, and the wind plant is expected to stay near that power level for the next 5 minutes. Wind plants face penalties if they fail to do so, just like any other power plant now. This works because MISO is now carefully forecasting the wind power and using that forecast in a very smart way. Wind forecasts are actually very accurate for the next few minutes. MISO uses a very short-term forecast for their dispatch, only 10 minutes ahead of each 5-minute period, so the forecast is very accurate. Because MISO tells the wind plant how much power it expects to receive from them every 5 minutes, wind plants fit into the markets and operations just like other generators. MISO considers wind plants to be fully dispatchable. Wind is now fully participating in the MISO markets as a result of this. And yes, energy prices may be lower, I think largely due to low natural gas prices in the market as a whole. But you know, in general, low prices are good for the consumers and the ratepayers as well. With regard to MISO, the incremental amount of wind that is proposed by this bill would have only a modest impact on MISO's capabilities and plans. MISO is already planning to support 25,000 megawatts of wind based on the existing portfolio standards, and this would be about 12% of MISO's total energy. They're also in the midst, as you know, of transmission build-outs and methodical planning and building processes to support this. This bill would increase that 12% to 14% in MISO, an increase that can be handled through normal ongoing development of our power system. This does not require significant studies or new technologies to accomplish. It's really an ongoing evolution and normal planning process as we move forward. So I am very confident in our ability to reliably and economically integrate more wind and renewables for Minnesota. I confidently support the 40% renewable energy standard, and I urge you to support the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Ahlstrom? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier is Christy Rosenquist from the Coalition for Sensible Siting.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you're with for the tape, and then proceed.
My name is Christy Rosenquist. I live in rural Goodhue County. Thank you for allowing citizens to speak today. Wind is the cornerstone of Minnesota's renewable energy standard, and House File 880 continues this. No matter how much tax and rate money you spend, wind will never be a baseload energy source. Wind has never replaced a single coal plant in the United States or in any other part of the world. Some of those coal plants are being replaced by natural gas because of the restrictions being placed on coal plants. The state of Minnesota mandated wind, and the federal government put about $4 billion a year into wind between 2008 and 2011. I would suggest that if you outlawed plastic barrels and put a few billion mandated wooden barrels and put a few billion at it, that industry would be booming also. I first met our local wind developer in Goodhue County over three years ago, and after listening to them very carefully, I asked them, if there was no state mandate and billions of federal dollars, you wouldn't be here, would you? And they said, no, we wouldn't be here. I've had a front row seat to the implementation of the 2007 renewable energy standards, and I think it's vital that you know from a citizen's perspective what's going on in rural Minnesota, not just from people sitting in boardrooms and not just from the models that you receive that are called studies from the wind industry to promote their industry. This law exempts wind from all electrical regulatory laws that were designed to protect ratepayers. It exempts wind from regulatory laws that would protect human health. It exempts wind from regulatory laws that would protect the environment and prime agricultural production land. The Minnesota legislature built a superhighway to the federal tax money and Minnesota's electrical rate money. In theory, this was done to achieve the dream that industrial wind turbines will save the planet from global warming. I have asked several of the people who were key to making that law, including Ellen Anderson and Bill Grant, to please show me any scientific studies that were used to make our renewable energy standard in 2007 that would demonstrate that wind turbines are going to save the planet from global warming. They both told me unequivocally there were no scientific studies that showed that. The Minnesota Department of Commerce got the legislature's message loud and clear. Their energy facilities permitting staff holds public meetings because they are required by law. Treating citizens' input with respect and giving any consideration to citizens in siting wind turbines is not required by law, and it does not happen. Instead, Commerce staff, who we are told are neutral fact finders, open public meetings by reading wind poetry and blatantly advocate for the wind developers at public meetings and in front of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. After performing every wind promotion short of donning cheerleading skirts and waving pom-poms, Commissioner Dennis O'Brien finally ordered the energy facilities permitting staff to stop advocating for the wind developer during a hearing. At the insistence of citizens, Goodhue County updated their wind ordinance in 2010. The county asked the state specifically, what scientific studies did you use to determine your wind siting standards? And the answer was, there were no scientific studies. The state adopted the standards that Enron said would work They were an earlier wind developer in the 1990s in Minnesota. We still use the Enron standards for siting wind. Other counties, including Nicollet and Wabasha, have similar ordinances to Goodhue's. Citizens were assured by legislators from both parties during the 2010 session that the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission would apply the Goodhue County Ordinance, and instead, every portion of that ordinance was thrown out. They even threw out safe road setbacks, identical to those already applied in other counties, including Jackson and Yellow Medicine. The Goodhue County Wind Project, I believe, has proven that there is no wind project so grotesque and so egregious that the state of Minnesota would not permit it. I believe that Goodhue County is one of the sweet spots in the sweet spot study. Goodhue Wind, AWA Goodhue, New Era, whatever you want to call the project, in Goodhue County was designated as community-based energy development. The project has zero Minnesota owners. I would estimate between 94 and 96% of the revenue over the life of the project will likely flow out of state, and Goodhue County is opposed to the project. When citizens protested that this was not a seabed project, you changed the state law to make sure that you could accommodate this project and all future non-seabed projects that want this extra preferential seabed largesse. Goodhue County is the first project in the nation to apply for an incidental take permit to allow the killing of bald eagles without any danger of federal prosecution. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates that 8 to 14 eagles will die every year if this project is built according to the state design permitted. The certified wildlife biologist hired to study the Goodhue Wind Project area testified verbally and in writing to the Public Utilities Commission that in 2010 there were zero eagles in the project footprint. The public docket already contained citizens' photographs and testimony about the eagles' presence there. Now, through the efforts of citizens, working with conservation agencies, including U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Minnesota DNR, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates that there are 418 eagles and 9 confirmed eagle nests in the study area. So either the wind company was lying to get their permit, or perhaps we should contact the Vatican, because we have a miracle. Eagles have appeared where there were none. A study on Minnesota's Buffalo Ridge showed a 47% loss of raptors at wind facilities. The loss was immediate. This loss continued 10 years later when they were studying the issue. How can anyone believe that a 47% loss of raptors is sustainable and a benefit to the environment? Bat slaughter is even higher at our wind facilities. They are a keystone species that is absolutely essential for pest control. Wind developers tell people that wind turbines make no more noise and no different noise than the refrigerator in your kitchen. Do you know any people who are sick or abandoning their homes because of their household refrigerator? I don't. Wind developers want you to think that turbine noise problem is just a bunch of crazy, whiny wind haters. I guess I'm in good standing. The Minnesota Public Department of Health clearly knows that low-frequency noise is a problem, and I would encourage legislators to speak with Linda Bremer of the Department of Health about the issue. Paul Austin, the former commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, told me that Minnesota does not have a noise standard that measures turbine noise, and we have plenty of new scientific evidence to show that that is true. And yet, faulty noise models using the non-applicable noise standard is the sole factor in Minnesota used to determine the distance between my house and a turbine. There was one hearing in 2010 in the legislature on a bill that would have provided greater setbacks in highly populated rural areas to protect human health. The bill was killed in committee in part by the efforts of Representative Andrew Falk, a wind developer. The committee chair, Representative Rod Hamilton, instructed the wind industry to treat citizens' concerns and complaints seriously and to behave better. But I ask you, why would Wall Street and European-owned wind developers care about protecting Minnesota when the Minnesota legislature clearly does not? Actions speak louder than words. Through the current 2007 RES, the legislature said to wind developers, we don't care about ratepayers, we don't care about human health, and we don't care about the environment. I believe that House File 880 is a bill to increase electric rates, increase human suffering, and ensure environmental degradation, and I encourage you to reject it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to ask all the testifiers from here forward to keep their comments to 3 minutes. If you keep your comments to 3 minutes, we can get through everybody. The next testifier is Steve Franco from the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Good
morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Steve Frankel. I'm the Midwest Office Director of the Union of Concerned Scientists. UCS is a 40-year-old nonprofit organization. Our work is based on rigorous scientific research and analysis. We have 7,000 members here in Minnesota, part of our national network of over 400,000 supporters. I wanted to focus today on some of the economic issues associated with compliance with the Renewable Energy Standard in Minnesota. I realize we're time is short, so I'll try and hit a few highlights. As you know, the RES is a market-based mechanism. And it's a tool that helps correct some of the market distortions in our energy marketplace. The price of pollution is not baked into our current energy market prices, right? It's the price of particulate matter, soot, mercury pollution, and carbon dioxide pollution is not reflected in today's energy markets. And so the public policy you put in place helps level the playing field for clean energy resources that otherwise can't compete on a level playing field. But within that mechanism, there's price discipline. It's a competitive marketplace within the renewable energy market. So you have renewable energy developers bidding against each other through competitive RFPs to try and deliver clean energy at an affordable price. And that's what we've seen here in Minnesota and, in fact, across the nation and across the region. As you know, Xcel, Minnesota Power, and others have been able to comply with the RES very cost-effectively with price increases in the range of less than 1% to slightly above 1%. And this is consistent with what we've seen nationally and across the region. In fact, Lawrence Berkeley National Labs looked at 14 states, 13 of which had rate impacts in terms of renewable energy compliance of less than 1%. So Minnesota is very much in keeping with the affordability of renewable energy across the country. And so I think it's a good sign. Part of what's driving this is the steep decline in the price of renewable energy technologies. Wind power has dropped by 90% since 1980, and including a 20% decrease just in the last 2 years. And solar technologies have dropped by 75% since 2008, even steeper and more rapid decline. So I think that's a good sign and promising for the future of renewable energy development in Minnesota and beyond in terms of providing clean energy at an affordable price for ratepayers. And your own Department of Commerce, Division of Energy Resources, as you've heard earlier, has found this to be the case in terms of deeming compliance with the RES to be cost-effective to date. And so, and the utility companies themselves, by and large, have found no significant rate impacts. Now,
Thank
we've
you.
Heard from the
Can you wrap up?
Yes, sure. That's fine. Last point I want to make is that in terms of natural gas prices, we know natural gas prices are low today. But the natural gas price markets don't trade more than a year ahead of time. And because of that uncertainty, it's impossible to lock in an affordable natural gas price today. So relying on that assumption of affordability of natural gas prices is very risky, and the longevity of a fixed price wind or solar contract can provide a good insurance policy against that volatility in natural gas prices. Thank you so much for your
Thank you.
Time.
Our next testifier is Deb Bergen from Missouri River Energy.
Chairman Hortman, if you don't mind, we have Steve Thompson here from Central Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. Could he take my place?
Yes, he certainly may.
Thank you.
Or you can pull up another chair, too, if you'd like. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you're with for the record and proceed.
I'm Steve Thompson. I'm the CEO of Central Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. Our agency, you know, is a member-owned or it's a consumer-owned agency, so, I mean, you know, we don't have shareholders. We are a small agency. We're only 21,000 retail customers. 27% of our households are considered low-income, so any kind of rate impacts do have large impact on us. We don't think this legislation, you know, is necessary at this time. CMMPA is already very progressive. 23% of our energy comes from wind today. We get an additional 16% from WAPA Hydro and another 12% from nuclear, so 51% of our energy today is already carbon-free. I know the intent of this legislation may be good, but we do have some concerns about it. One of the first concerns we have is that we think it is going to, you know, adversely affect the pricing of new projects. Every time we make changes to the, you know, to the RS obligations, it really creates a seller's market, and there is opportunistic pricing that happens as a result of that. to give you some more information on that, some of our cheapest wind that SAM-MPA has was the stuff we purchased before we even had an RES in the state. Just the production tax credit was adequate enough to make wind projects, start to become adequate. As soon as the, imposed the actual RES, what we seen was within about a year to year and a half after the RES was imposed, the price of wind projects went from the low 30s to the mid 30s to $70 a megawatt hour. They have since then, now that after everyone has caught up with their compliance requirements, now it has gone back to the $30 to $35 per megawatt hour range. So it does have an adverse effect. There are unintended, consequences, when we do these mandates. Second point I want to make is that, just to put it into perspective, I don't think people realize our load is 120 megawatts peak, 25 megawatts off peak. The 25% RES equates to 35 megawatts of wind that we would have to install nameplate. If you increase it to 40%, we have to install 65 megawatts of wind to meet our 40% RES, and our minimum load is 25. Okay? Someone earlier today suggested that MISO solved that problem, that we can dispatch these things now. But the problem is, if you dispatch our wind generator 20% of the time, our effective cost of the wind goes up 20%. So, it may be a solution as far as reliability, but it's not an economic solution. So in order for us to get this 40% RES, we cannot do it without some type of energy storage or additional massive transmission. Our transmission rates have, in the last 5 years, doubled, okay? And in the next 10 years, projections of just taking what MISO's transmission expansion plans are, our transmission rates are going to double again. What's been the major driver of transmission rates going up? It's been the wind. There's another cost that we're not even including into this. Our transmission costs used to be so cheap that we ignored them. They weren't that significant. They are becoming a significant part of our portfolio cost now. The other thing that happens when we have excess wind is that it drives our prices down low, and we end up selling into the market at a loss. Last year, we lost $3 million, in lost revenue that we sold our wind into the market at a lower cost than what we paid for it. That had a 10% negative rate impact on our consumers.
Can you wrap up? Sorry about time being short. If you could wrap up.
Okay, one other last point I want to make is that we have currently, must take contracts that last 30 years. If we have to go to the 40% wind, we will be forced to buy more energy than we can use on an annual basis. We will be long on energy. There will be sunk cost issues with this. The other thing that it would do to us is that we are currently looking at, options like large hydro options. Large hydro, or hydro in general, is dispatchable, has a very fast ramp rate, it's a perfect resource in order to follow the wind. But if you force this 40% RES on us, that will preempt us to probably even considering a large hydro project. And wouldn't you rather have a large hydro project, backfilling for the wind than a gas turbine? So the 40% RES starts taking away flexibility in our portfolio planning. At a minimum, if we were to go to the 40%, currently large hydro does not qualify for a qualifying resource. We would encourage you to at least expand large hydro to be included in at that point.
Thank you for your testimony. Will you leave your contact information with the committee administrator so we can follow up with questions? Thank you very much. Betsy Engelking is the next testifier. Welcome to the committee. Thank you. I'm sorry that time is short.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. I'll try to talk fast here. I'm Betsy Engelking. I am Vice President at Geronimo Energy. And like many people in this room, I have had the privilege to participate, witness, implement, and do all sorts of other things with the state's clean energy policy over the last 25 years of my career in the Minnesota energy industry. Every time a legislative policy has come up about enhancing, improving, implementing clean energy We have had the same thing. We have had utilities coming to the table and talking about how it was either impossible, expensive, unreliable, and all sorts of other reasons why they have not, you know, they would not support a standard or they would not be able to do a standard. Each time that the legislature has gone ahead and implemented those policies, the utilities have accomplished them faster, cheaper, and better than even people in the industry, in the clean energy sphere had imagined that they could. And we have seen the same thing with this 25 by 25 standard. When we pass standards like this, for example, the 2007 standard, they look scary and unknown. And as a result, we build a lot of safeguards into those things to make sure that bad things don't happen. Once we have a few years of implementing the standard, we discover that bad things haven't happened. For example, as Representative Adkins pointed out earlier, no one has ever implemented an off-ramp. Even though some testifiers today come up with scary numbers like 70% rate increases and big disparities between what they're paying for wind and what market power is, their reports, which they file officially with the Public Utilities Commission, belie those numbers, and in fact, we have not seen them. The Renewable Energy Standard is a long-term policy, and we cannot use short-term rate impact, short-term fuel prices, and other things to determine its worth and its value. I am going to speak specifically to one aspect because I know I have other industry people following me, and I'm going to talk about the REC banking issue. REC banking was one of those things that was built in as part of the unknown things to happen. Let me be clear. We believe in a REC bank. We believe that it has a lot of benefits, but we also believe that Minnesota was a little too conservative when it set its REC bank. When we compare Minnesota's REC banking of the year of generation plus 4 years with other states, there are only two states in the country that have higher standards, Ohio at 5 years and California at 9 years, but we all know that California is crazy. If we look at the majority of states that have standards, those states are, most of them have a one-year or a two-year bank. Maine has a one-year bank, and D.C., Delaware, Illinois, Massachusetts, Maryland, New Hampshire, Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island all have a two-year bank. We believe that what we have learned is that this bank is very extensive. Understanding that the REC bank does not actually require anybody to do any more, shortening the REC bank won't require anybody to do any more energy. It will simply require them to do energy, implement renewable energy faster. And to just give you some examples.
Thank you. We unfortunately don't have time for the examples. We're going to move on to our next testifier. That was really good. You said a lot in 3 minutes. Our next testifier is Ben Gerber from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. How much can you fit in 3 minutes, Ben?
I'll try my best. Thank you, Chair Hortman, members of the committee. My name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'll talk as fast as I can. The most important issue that I want to bring up is that this, we keep hearing about this report. These reports are not finalized. The Public Utilities Commission has an open docket, and I believe Chair Hortman and Chair Marty both received letters. We just filed another report because we have issues with the way that a lot of these cost impacts were studied. So I think it's a little premature to now say, to keep saying that these reports are conclusive and that they're all-encompassing, because there's a lot of problems with them that we've had experts, and I think other people would agree that that there are issues. The second, I don't often agree with Representative Falk, but we would agree on one thing, and that is that the over-reliance on the potential for natural gas. But we would disagree on why that's happening. We believe that the reason There is a concern about natural gas prices, and that's because we're building out more and more wind and solar, which need that backup generation. I would guess this committee would not want to do what Germany did, which is just commission two 1,100-megawatt peaking coal facilities. And peaking coal facilities are a new kind of technology where they were able to enhance some of the steel to deal with the ramp-ups, and they're about 50. They can ramp up in about 50% of the time that a natural gas plant can do. So, you know, while they're not as effective, they're still there. And I'd also say that we keep hearing about off-ramps, and I would posit that off-ramps are almost meaningless in this context. I think they provide a lot of their political necessity, but they're not an actual realistic necessity. Once you've already built the infrastructure, you either have to recover it from your ratepayers or your owners in cooperatives or municipals, or because I don't think that the utilities are going to eat the cost. So I think while we can keep saying that there's off-ramps, the effectiveness of the off-ramps is essentially nothing. I think what we have seen is the increasing reliance on renewables from 1990, and I've talked about this before. We were the 12th lowest in rates for commercial rates, and industrial rates were 15th. By 2011, we were 18th and 25th and 19th overall. And that 19th includes residential customers. So that means our residential customers are also paying significantly more than they used to. It is concerning for me. We've had scientists and experts come up here and say that renewables are cost competitive, and that they're in some cases are least cost alternative. But then why do we need the RES? No one has addressed the logic there. The Public Utilities Commission has a pretty comprehensive process to look at the needs of utilities and determine what resources are cost-effective and necessary. And if that's the case, then I think that's this policy is not going to fix that. If they're truly cost-competitive, we don't even need the renewable energy standard. The other thing that I've heard, that people want more and more solar. And I said this before when we heard the solar bill. There's nothing in the current law that prevents anybody from installing solar generation on the rooftop. The reason that people aren't doing it is because of cost. It's not cost competitive. And so then we have to come up with incentives, and somebody has to pay for those incentives, and that's other ratepayers, and that's concerning for us as well.
Thank you. Appreciate your input.
Well, thank you. And I hope that we can have a longer discussion, because I think this is a drastic change in policy, and 3 hours is not enough time for most of the people on both sides, so I appreciate it.
I wish we had infinite time, but this morning we do not. But thank you very much for your testimony, and we will continue to call on you to provide input as the bills come forward. The next testifier is Byron Christopher from South Fork Wind Farm. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Byron Christopher. I'm from Southwest Minnesota, here with my wife, Kathy. And I'm here to share some good economic news about wind generation instead of all this negative stuff I've heard. We've developed two wind projects, and in Jackson County, right now, that's where we're from, in Jackson County, there's approximately 400 megawatts of wind. Now, this wind makes people a lot of money out there. It's a very good economic thing to have. For one thing, we've got one township. Well, first let me go back. Every bit of wind is taxed. That tax goes to the townships, counties, and the state. And we've got one township out there that's taking in over $200,000 just on tax. Now, those guys worked their butts off trying to figure out where they were going to get money to run the township years ago. Now they're working their butts off trying to figure out how they can spend this money wisely. Our county is taking in between $1 million and $2 million just from taxes a year. This is going to go on and on and on. This is not going to quit. And the people that have the wind towers are taking in between $6,000 and $10,000 a year per wind tower. One farmer out there, his family and everything, have 18 towers. I mean, this is a big economic boom for Jackson County, and I just can't see why people are against this. I realize there are some downfalls and some people that don't like wind and stuff like that, but it was that way when the cars came out, when the electricity came out, television. There's always somebody against it, but just think where we'd be if we didn't have cars or electricity. or cell phones, we'd be way back, you know. And this, to me, is one chance for the state of Minnesota to go forward with this wind energy system thing and just make it ourselves here in Minnesota. This is all about Minnesota, you know. We got to work for Minnesota here. The coal and the natural gas and everything that comes out of state, someday that's going to run out. We've got the best resource and the cleanest resource there is in the world, and it's wind. All we got to do is capture it and use it. That'll help Minnesota economically, and all these other reports that you're hearing about how we're going to go in the hole and it costs so much. Well, I'll tell you what, if you can lock in 3-cent electricity for 20 or 30 years, you're going to be competitive. I don't care what they say.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Thanks for making the drive up to the Capitol this morning. Our next testifier is Barb Stussy or Stussy from Zumbrota. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Barb Stussy, and I'm from Zumbrota, Minnesota. Sunshine and wind are free. Making electricity from sun and wind is not. House File 880 is not just a solar bill. House File 8880 increases the renewable energy mandate to 40%, increases the specific mandate for wind from 20 to 25%, and changes the renewable energy trading system to make it more difficult for Minnesota utilities to manage the high implementation costs. The Minnesota legislature sent a clear message through their 2007 RES. We don't care about ratepayers, human health, or the environment. House File 8880 perpetuates that message. Fresh Energy employee J. Drake Hamilton has been traveling around Minnesota explaining that wind is a benefit to rural economies because in 2011, between $6 and $7 million went to rural landowners, counties, and townships. According to the Minnesota Rural Electric Association in 2011, rural ratepayers lost $70 million just on the portion of the wind electricity being generated when it cannot be used or sold. To me, this sounds like a $64 million loss to rural Minnesota ratepayers for that year. This multi-million dollar loss does not count the $1 million per turbine in federal stimulus cash spent on each turbine built between 2008 and 2011. It also does not count the $2 million being spent on CapEx 2020 transmission lines to keep the grid from crashing when the wind energy is forced onto the grid at times when Minnesotans can't use it. And CapEx promises to carry wind electricity to the East Coast, who neither needs it nor wants it. Last fall in December of 2012, there was a forum in Rochester, Minnesota, which I attended and included Senator Dave Senjum, people from the University of Minnesota, and was moderated by PUC Commissioner Boyd. From that forum, these things were taken away. We are to learn these things from Germany, in that German industrial electrical rates have gone up 40% in the past 5 years. German manufacturing businesses are fleeing the country. Germany dumps its wind electricity produced when they can't use it on the grids of neighboring countries. Germany learned that placing large industrial wind turbines close to homes causes health problems. The minimum setback between a home and a wind turbine is 3,281 feet. The Minnesota minimum setback standard is 500 feet. Minnesota's existing renewable energy mandate was passed in 2007. Wind is the cornerstone. At a public EQB forum last fall, also held in Rochester, citizens asked former Senator Dayton's Special Energy Advisor, Ellen Anderson, the question, what scientific studies or experimental data from existing wind turbines were used to create the Minnesota wind mandate? Ms. Anderson's response was, there weren't any. Bill Grant, head of the Department of Commerce EFP division, was also asked the same question at that same forum, and we got the same answer. Because so much of Minnesota's RES was written by lawyers and lobbyists to benefit their corporate clients. Citizens thought perhaps Minnesota legislators just don't know that they exempted wind regulatory laws. Most legislators have been fully aware of the exemptions. The most common response was, we assumed wind didn't have negative health consequences, we assumed there were no negative environmental effects, and we assumed wind would replace coal plants. These assumptions turned out to be both baseless and wrong. A friend asked Bill Grant, the head of Commerce's Energy Facility Permitting Division, why wind was exempt from the Minnesota regulatory laws. And Mr. Grant explained that the design goal was for Minnesota to install as much wind as possible, as quickly as possible, to get as much out of the federal tax money as possible. This does not sound like an environmental benefit, a human health benefit, or a benefit to ratepayers. The Minnesota legislature sent a clear message through the 2007 RES. We don't care about ratepayers, human health, or the environment. House File 880 perpetuates that message. It appears to me that that file is a bill to increase human suffering. I personally encourage you to reject it. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Chanel Evans, Montana.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chanel Montana, and I'm with EDF Renewable Energy, and I am here to talk a little bit about some of the developer's perspective along with some of the supply chain company perspective. And first and foremost, I would like to thank some of my colleagues and coworkers who are here from Southwestern and Southeastern Minnesota who work on a number of our projects, a number of the projects in Minnesota. You can see them in the crowd. They made a long trip up here. We are an integrated operator of renewable energy and have developed over 900 megawatts of wind in the state of Minnesota with many very successful projects. And throughout our time in development, we did complete the Lakefield Wind Project, and I would like to focus on that today and talk a little bit about some of the economics behind that. I'm going to skip ahead in my presentation, which the committee should have, and go to page 3, where it just has a very simple pie chart of some of the spending that is done during the construction period of a project. And it very clearly illustrates that about 3/4 of all of the spending in construction actually happens here in Minnesota. That is millions of dollars that's staying in Minnesota that's being spent in Minnesota companies, both within that project area, within a 50-mile radius of that project area, and then throughout the rest of Minnesota. The Lakefield project was a 205-megawatt project constructed by Mortenson Construction, and it used over 75 Minnesota companies, and that created many jobs and provided a lot of income for rural Minnesotans. During that project, we spent almost $40 million in supplies and services for Minnesota companies, and created about 170 construction positions during that time. Not only is this a project that infused money into the local area through businesses, but it also infused money into the local area through tax revenue and landowner payments. To date, my company has paid over $11 million in landowner payments for these projects. That money has been a sustainable income for farmers who oftentimes do not have a steady, standard, sustainable income. Crop prices obviously go up and down very frequently. Some of the businesses that were helped out and affected by the Lakefield Wind Project include businesses in Freeport and St. Cloud, Minnesota, Springfield, Lakefield, and Jackson, Minnesota, as well as a number of businesses in the Twin Cities area, and a lot of those were highlighted in my presentation. During construction, we also see an influx of money going into the local community through hotels, entertainment. Obviously, construction workers need to eat, etc. And so when you talk to people from that area, they will tell you of the huge influx of capital that came into that community and what that did for their local tax base. Just to sum things up, Minnesota developers, supply chain companies, etc., and Minnesota landowners or farmers are prepared and ready to meet this goal that we want to set for the state of Minnesota. When you look in the MISO queue, you see almost 3,500 megawatts that are in some stage of development for the state of Minnesota. And developers, they want to develop that. Farmers want those projects to be developed, and we're excited to do so. And we thank you for considering this bill. We think it'll do a lot for the state.
Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier is Marie McNamara. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Marie McNamara.
Go ahead.
House File 880 should be thrown out. I know that sounds like a real bold statement here coming out, but the previous testifier from EDP, the P in that is Portugal. That's a foreign entity, and the Portugal project that was right near us by Kenyon, we've been tracking it through FAA website, and a lot of the trade secrets that we find are happening with the renewable industry are egregious and should be looked at by the legislature. We don't know what wind speeds are. I live in a township by the Goodyear Wind Project, and the wind speeds in their applications are coming from down by Albert Lee. We can't tell what's coming off the Met Towers. We can't see any cost, and I think the legislature should be very cautious about getting trade secrets looked at a little bit more. Last Thursday, many of us were over at the Public Utilities Commission, and the commission could not see fit to deny one wind project, one permit, or look at their certificate of need when there's a lot of problems there. At the hearing, we heard a lot of things about the determination. The PUC said, we don't have enough information. It's a bad project, and it's accumulated the largest docket in Minnesota history, and I have a information sheet to give you, and I'd encourage you to check it out, especially on the human health docket. Xcel said there, we're still in negotiations. They admit that the wind project's in default, so I guess I would call this probably a pass-the-buck category thing. Then we go to the Department of Commerce, and I find this to be one of the biggest problems, and it does relate directly to House File 880, if you bear with me. The Department of Commerce made a comment that long ago in this project that there are no eagles or eagle flight paths in the Goodyear project area. And since it's Friday and I can talk a little faster if I show pictures, I would say that no, that's not true. There's plenty of eagles in the project, and the citizens had to step up and had to point out to wildlife agencies that, yeah, there are eagles in this project. And so I really have a complaint here, and I think it does bear in mind the 40%. And what I really want to address today is health. Why would you possibly consider a bill to increase the mandate to 40% when the current mandate is being managed so poorly? We're a small dairy farm, and we are also organic, and we're very concerned about sustainability, and we're very concerned about what we have for emissions and how we farm. I'd like to focus, too, on the important new information that's coming out, and I'll just run through this quickly because it's on my information sheet that I'll give you. December 11th, MPUC Commissioner Boyd facilitated the forum down in Rochester you heard about. I, too, attended that forum. I asked the German delegates directly to contrast what I've heard about the length of setbacks in German states. It's 1,000 meters over here. That's 3,300 feet. In Minnesota here, we have 500 feet, and we also have to satisfy sound standards of 50 decibels. This is unacceptable. Before you would go ahead with a House File 880 or the Senate companion bill, I would say that the legislature should take a strong look at setbacks. It might work in Jackson, Minnesota. It might work in Representative Fox District, but it's not working where there's home-dense townships, and it's not working where there's livestock operations. And my family has to be on the farm all the time. Commissioner Austin, as you heard testify or say, has also commented when asked, we don't have a noise standard that's designed to work for turbines. October 13th, the MPUC asked for a report, and it also brought out the finding that noise is produced by wind turbines, and it differs fundamentally from the noise emitted by other power facilities. It needs to be addressed. Wisconsin's Shirley Wind Project, and I've got a quick visual here, if I can get it straight up, that has just come out, too, at the end of 2012, and this needs to be addressed. It needs to be looked at. What it proves conclusively by four firms that there's a fingerprint on the inside of the house, and there's a fingerprint on the outside of the house from low-frequency noise. And our state has unacceptable standards here. The people there are suffering. Only 8 turbines and 3 people have left their homes. So I'll conclude by saying there's three real quick examples. 10 days ago, February 26th, Falmouth, Massachusetts, they voted to take down 2 turbines. And in April, they're going to put it on their ballot to vote to tax themselves to take down these turbines because of the low-frequency noise. That's egregious. Most troubling is the plight of Minnesota citizens, and I think they're here today, Bernie and Cheryl Hagan. They live in the Bent Tree Project. Bernie has talked to Governor Dayton many times and the previous administration. He's been advised by his VA doctors to abandon his home. Severe negative health effects are really influencing there. And then 3 days ago, on March 5th, the Maine Supreme Court, now this just happened just this week, they vacated the sound requirement on one of their big wind projects there. They backed it up from Maine standard of 45 decibels to 42 decibels. It was a court decision.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. We have to go on to the next person.
Yeah, sure. And I just want to say this is not unlike our tobacco situation. The wind industry knows this is a problem, and we have to address it. And I'd like to give my testimony to the...
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing that. Thank you for making the trip. Adam Sokolowski from... He can say the name of the company when he gets down here. And I've been kind of letting people go 4 minutes, but really if people can tighten it up because we have 12 people and 20 minutes. So please state your name for the record and who you're with and your comments as quickly as possible.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Adam Sokolsky. I'm with Iberdrola Renewables. I've been working in wind and energy for about 10 years. I'm a Minnesotan, born and raised here. Kids go to public schools. I live in the Twin Cities area. I'm a project developer for Iberdrola Renewables. Iberdrola is a global company, one of the larger wind farm owner operators in the world with about 5,500 megawatts operating. And about 550 megawatts of that is right here in Minnesota. Our Minnesota operating projects pay about $2.2 million in total annual what we call production taxes. That's in lieu of property tax. that goes to the state, and then is redistributed to the counties and to the townships. And we pay millions more in annual payments to landowners, landowner groups, as well as to vendors that we use locally to help us at our wind farm projects. We directly employ approximately 55 people in Minnesota, primarily in the operations and maintenance category, but also others who do permitting, who develop new projects, and who do health and safety work, electrical engineering work. I'll limit my testimony here today simply to the certificate of need portion of the bill. I think other testifiers will cover other portions of the bill. In Minnesota, we have a certificate of need. That bill, that law is almost 40 years old now. It was developed in the 1970s when utilities were building large central station power plants for their native load prior to the MISO markets, prior to robust day-ahead markets. It was a different system. It was a different time. The certificate of need was never designed for today's current energy market. We have independent power producers today who might want to build a wind farm in Minnesota and export that energy like you would corn or beans or milk or hogs to purchasers in a different state. The certificate of need statute never envisioned that. It's not well suited to handle those types of reviews and transactions. And we found problems with it over the last 5 years or so. The certificate of need was also designed prior to the wide implementation of what's called integrated resource planning, which is a tool that utilities use across Minnesota to look forward into the future, determine what projects are going to be needed, what type of energy loads they're going to have in the future, and how to most cost effectively supply their consumers with energy. The certificate of need is so far out of date that developers like me have to spend our own time and money, as well as the public's money, through the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission. So we're taking state resources to go through and ask for specific exemptions from the data filing requirements under the certificate of need statutes that simply don't apply to an independent power producer who's trying to sell energy either to someone like Xcel Energy or Great River or to an out-of-state entity that might be 3 states away. What is the time? What's the time and the cost? I'd estimate just for a developer, over $100,000 of fees as well as additional time in the regulatory process just to simply comply with that portion of the statutes. Instead, I'd rather use that money to better, but to focus more time and attention on the siting aspects, more time and attention for other aspects that the regulatory community, the state, the general public is interested in, instead of kind of wasting it on a certificate of need process that doesn't really work. It's kind of jamming a square peg into a round hole.
Please wrap up.
Okay. Wow, that's fast. Finally, I think one of the important considerations is certificate of need. I've seen this numerous times in a variety of energy dockets. It frustrates the general and affected public. People want to know, just like the Goodhue folks who are here today talking, where the turbines are going to go, where are the roads going to go, what are the impacts, what are the mitigation measures, when's the project going to get built, rather than a pie in the sky, very large picture analysis of a potential generic project.
I'll be
here on Monday, Representative Hortman. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Paul Reese from Goodhue Township.
Thank you. Hi.
Welcome to the committee.
Paul Reese. Spelled just like it sounds. That was a great introduction. I'd love to talk about independent power providers. But first of all, I'd like you to become aware of Eric Rosenblum's paper on the Danish study. Denmark reached a renewable energy standard of 20%. It was a disaster, a very well-documented disaster. While it reached 20% of their energy consumed, it actually only met about 1.7% of their energy needs because it was produced when it wasn't needed. And they had to dump it onto Germany, who I understand is now passing the buck and dumping it onto some of the other countries. To basically wrap up half of my testimony, become aware of the Danish study. It's fantastic. The certificate of need process that the independent power providers have a problem with was designed to explore the impacts that wind and other projects would have on the grid, find issues, potential problems, come up with some sort of a plan. The independent power providers think that they are some way exempt from that, as if their projects don't have an impact on the grid. They're already exempt from virtually all of the certificate of need demands. But when they run into a virtually all of the certificate of need demands, but when they run into an issue, and we've seen this time and time again, the Public Utilities Commission asks something of an independent power provider, and their answer is, we don't want to answer that. They just flat out refuse to answer. So rather than relax the certificate of need restraints on independent power providers, I think you need to really do some in-depth investigation into these independent power providers. In most cases, and it's getting even more common, these independent power providers are not based in Minnesota, and they're not based in the country. They're taking Minnesota incentive money to wherever. So I'm getting the hook, aren't I?
No, you actually weren't. You have a minute.
That's all right. I'll roll it forward.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your succinct comments. The next testifier is Aaron Tippy. And on deck are Ann and Dave Buck. Is Aaron Tippy here? He is. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name and who you're with for the record.
Aaron Tippy with Westwood Professional Services. I will be brief. I'm the director of the power sector for Westwood Professional Services. Westwood is a consulting firm of approximately 200 people, headquartered in Eden Prairie. We have a second Minnesota office located in St. Cloud and several other offices outside of the state. We provide a variety of services related to the engineering, land surveying, and environmental permitting of wind energy projects, among other industries. Westwood has been involved in Minnesota's wind business since 1997. As Minnesota's wind industry has grown significantly in the past 15 years, so has our company. Wind projects have evolved from being a niche piece of our business to being a key source of revenue and a driver for new jobs within Westwood. We employ numerous civil engineers, land surveyors, design and drafting technicians, hydrologists, mapping technicians, archaeologists, and environmental scientists in our Minnesota offices to serve this industry. We have also been able to export our wind energy expertise to serve projects in many other states, all the while supporting jobs here in Minnesota. The state's wind industry leadership remains extremely important to us. We ask that the Commission support House File 880 and reaffirm Minnesota's role as a wind energy leader. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ann and Dave, Ann and Dave Buck, are they here? Oh, they are here. And I am really sorry that everybody's time is getting condensed, but I want to respect the fact that so many people came from so far and make sure that I figure you'd rather have 3 minutes than get bumped off the end of the list. So appreciate your understanding on the time limitations. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Ann Buck, and my family and I own and operate a dairy farm in southeast Minnesota in Goodhue County. And I will keep it short. I do have a handout so you can read about the other projects I'll cover. Many of you want to believe that Goodhue County's experience with industrial wind through the Goodhue Wind T. Boone Pickens New Era Wind Project is an isolated incident. The bad apple in an otherwise virtuous industry. I'm going to examine some of the other Minnesota's wind projects. Prairie Rose in Rock County, completed last year, the public record shows a landowner chasing the wind developer off their land with a brick. Another property, the wind developer broke their promise by permanently using parts of a landowner's property where they promised they would never go, cutting their fence lines, ruining their hay crop, and then refusing to reimburse the landowner for the full cost. J.P. Morgan and GE get the tax shelter, and Italian-owned Enel was lined up for the federal $1 million per turbine 1603 cash. Grand Meadow in Maurer County, owned by Xcel and completed in 2009. In the first 6 months of operation, they had burning underground electrical lines and exploding T-junctions. Last fall, Xcel replaced 6 to the 67 gearboxes at a reported cost of $360,000 each. French-owned Enexco got the $1 million per turbine federal 1603 cash. Nobles in Nobles County, owned by Xcel and completed in 2011, this project operated for 12 weeks before burning electrical cables and the replacement of all 134 brand new pad mounted transformers. Xcel requested a rate increase, telling the Public Utilities Commission that they learned from Grand Meadow and Nobles that wind turbines produce less electricity and cost more to maintain than anticipated. Xcel claims that they called around to other wind facilities and found this is common, produces less and costs more to maintain. French-owned Enexco got the $134 million in federal 1603 cash. Ratepayers get stuck with higher rates on high-maintenance, low-output turbines. And you can read about Elm Creek 2 in Lincoln County, Bent Tree in Freeborn County, Jeffers in Cottonwood County, Buffalo Ridge 2 in Pipestone County. Echo Harmony in Philbrook County is proposed, Spanish-owned Gamesa proposed siting 28 turbines on sinkholes. Turbines are sited in and around caves where bats hibernate, which ensures maximum bat kill. The wildlife study showed no eagles or eagle nests, but citizens' reports and photographs continue pouring into the public docket, just like the Goodhue Project. The Minnesota legislature made wind the cornerstone of the state's energy policy. The legislature sent a strong message that wind developers have taken to heart. You have no obligation to behave well and be respectful. I witnessed this firsthand 5 years ago when two competing industrial wind companies wanted use of our land.
I'm sorry, can you wrap up?
Yes. They used intimidation, bullying, threatening, and lying in their attempt to gain control of our property. Many other people in the community experienced the same thing. After talking to many people statewide and nationally, this appears to be standard operating procedure for wind developers. And in that issue, I'm just going to touch on it, population, home density. To meet the renewable energy standards, these projects are going into more populated areas, which there is going to be more health, safety, and environmental issues. We average 6 homes per section, where other projects only average 0 to 1 homes per section. So
thank you. I'm so sorry, there are 10 more people. Mr. Buck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One clarification. You have been listed as a Coalition for Sensible Siting. I don't actually belong to that, but I am married to one.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Buck.
As a farmer, I'm going to be brief and probably blunt. Laws that you pass have intended consequences and unintended consequences. It's the unintended consequences that scare me the most. I'll use ethanol as an example. It sounded good, but they grew it so fast and so much that it affected the price of corn so much, and that causes inflation throughout the system. I'm a little worried about this happening in this situation where you're going to keep asking for more and more. Our electric bill runs $3,000 a month. I would guess that's higher than probably everybody in this room. So I have reason for concern. And I thought I did until I talked to a grocery store owner, and it must have been a large grocery store. He said his was $30,000 a month, which I couldn't believe. And don't quote me on that, but it was just a huge number. We have to be careful of increasing costs. And you've heard conflicting testimony on wind costs versus other ones, but if wind is competitive, then why would we need a mandate to have it? So be very wary of that. We get our electricity from REA, and they have, I think another speaker mentioned how much money it's cost them and previous speakers, so it definitely is a concern. I think government's role in this is to find a solution and maybe subsidize the research to find that solution and not to pick a winner. And it just seems like we've picked a winner here or called it a winner, and we have to be careful about that.
Thank you both very much for coming to the Capitol and sharing your input. We really do value it, even though time is short. Next we have Pete Paris and Terrell Clark from the Blue Green Alliance. You guys know this place well, so I know you can be fast.
Madam Chair, Committee, good morning. My name is Pete Paris. I'm the political director for the Sheet Metal Workers Local Number 10. We are here today to testify in favor of House File 880. That would increase the state's renewable energy standards by 40% by 2030. The Sheet Metal Workers are a member of the Blue Green Alliance, a partnership of labor unions and environmental organizations creating good jobs and a clean economy. 3 days ago, we stood alongside our friends on the Minnesota Clean Energy Jobs Campaign to express our support for state legislation that advances the cause of creating good jobs in the development of clean, renewable energy in this state. House File 880 achieves that goal by increasing the state's RES to 40% by 2030. We can support good jobs in our state manufacturing, installing, operating renewable sources of energy. We can continue to grow a vibrant and forward-looking industry, and we can work together to protect the environment we all cherish for the next generation of Minnesotans. 6 years ago, our state came together in a bipartisan way to advance historic legislation that helps put Minnesota on the map when it comes to renewable energy. The historic RES legislation of 2007 established Minnesota as a center for renewable energy jobs. As of 2012, the wind industry provides up to 3,000 direct and indirect jobs in our state. According to the American Wind Energy Association, Minnesota's wind-related manufacturing accounted for 400 to 600 jobs, and our state's wind-related supply chain includes more than 100 companies. But we still have a lot more work to do, and that's why it's important to pass House File 880. Minnesota has fallen to seventh in the nation for installed wind farms. By increasing our RES, we can solidify our place in the wind industry, and we can support good jobs for Minnesotans, and we can continue a transition to clean, renewable energy. Clean, renewable energy supports good family supporting jobs in a broad range of fields, including truck drivers, crane operators, earth movers, cement workers, various construction and management consulting engineering positions. As a construction worker, these jobs are so important. Our sector by nature means that in order to build a career, we move from one job to the next. Building and investing in things like renewable energy supports good jobs in our sector and many others. And as Minnesotans, I cherish our lakes, streams, and rivers. I am an avid hunter, and I know that I want to do what I can to protect the environment for the next generation. These two goals are not mutually exclusive. Renewable energy can help us achieve these goals, and in order for our state to remain a leader, we must act now. I urge you to pass House File 880. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Clark.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Terrell Clark with the Blue Green Alliance, and I thought I could talk fast. As Mr. Paris said, we're here on behalf of the Blue Green Alliance, and the project I've been working on for the last 2 years nationally really is all about finding that sweet spot about how we're creating good, sustainable jobs, what we can do as a country and a state to make ourselves not only leaders globally, but how are we going to be competitive? And House File 880 is exactly the kind of public policy initiative that we need to not only keep our stronghold, but actually move forward. As I believe you are all aware, we have other countries such as Germany or China or Spain, I could go on and on, that really are making huge progress with renewables. If we want to go ahead and be the ones who are generating and creating the jobs as well as the energy, then this is our time to actually move forward. Otherwise, as you've heard, we will fall backwards, as we already have started to, in terms of installed wind farms. Increasing the RES will support good jobs, further develop an emerging and thriving industry in Minnesota, and help ensure a cleaner environment for our children and grandchildren. As Mr. Paris referred to, our RES standard in 2007 was nation-leading. But imagine right now if instead of what we're seeing in the Port of Duluth, which has been great over the last 6-7 years, we've seen a huge increase of port traffic that relates to handling freight tons of wind cargo, over 1 million every year, and it's ranked among the top 10 ports in North America for handling wind energy cargo. Imagine, though, as it's happening right now, that most of that's coming in, if we're the ones exporting out, that we're growing our supply chain here. Over 8,000 components are in each wind turbine. There's 250 tons of steel and thousands of tons of concrete. Those are things we could be doing here. So imagine if we were using our ore, our components, we were revitalizing rural Minnesota while we're also making our environment better and our energy cleaner for the future. Let's make sure that our kids and our grandkids are the ones that are saying that Minnesota had the foresight to drive the market for renewable energy, to create those good jobs and produce component parts for wind turbines and solar panels, and ensure our state is the center of renewable energy industry.
Thank you. And members, the speaker has given us permission to meet past noon, even though House rules generally prevent meetings to go past noon, but we will allow the testifiers to finish. So I'm sorry for members who were counting on leaving at noon. Feel free to leave if you have commitments. I have a commitment to Sophie Hortman that will cause me to leave shortly after we adjourn, but we can continue through the list. Margaret Hodnick is the next testifier.
Thank you, Chair Hortman. Committee members, appreciate the opportunity here to speak about House File 880. Minnesota Power is not in favor of House File 880, and I want to address right off the bat the questions we've heard about why utilities are concerned about reliability and rates. There's a really simple reason for that, and that's because when rates go up or the lights go off, we get the phone calls. The environmentalists don't get the phone calls, the wind developers don't get the phone calls, even legislators don't get the phone calls until later, but we're the ones that have to take responsibility for what rates are and what reliability is, so we care a great deal in the end, because we're not, it's our responsibility. We're concerned about the removing the flexibility of banking credits. It's important for cost control. Banking credits cover years of production when these variable resources from nature are not there. We can't count on them every year, so credits allow us to smooth out that natural variation. Credits are very important to Minnesota Power in this last year. We had a major flood up in Duluth, as everyone heard about. And our Thompson Hydro facility, that's 70 megawatts, is shut down entirely and not operating. So that hydro energy that we would normally be running and putting into our system as renewable is not there. Fortunately, we're able to cover that loss until we can get that facility back up and running, because we can bank credits and use those credits to cover that hydro energy that we're not able to produce at this time. Removal of banking will also lead to overbuilding facilities to cover years where there are shortages in production due to the natural flows of water and wind, as I noted, or solar for that matter. Removal of banking would threaten our ability to comply in years when the facilities don't produce. Regarding the 40% standard, I want to just echo Mr. Johnston's remarks that the 40% standard will greatly increase the volatility of the power system. And for those of us that have the responsibility 24 hours a day to make sure those lights stay on, we don't take that lightly. And the reliability impacts have not been analyzed, and it can't just happen with a magic wand or hope for type of thing. These things take planning and sophisticated studies to accomplish. Utilities, if there is going to be that much more wind on the system, would be forced to build significant amounts of transmission and companion generation to keep the lights on. There's been some comments made about the minimal to no rate impacts for the renewable energy standard to date, and we're really happy that there hasn't been a significant rate increase. That's something that we were striving for when we brought those resources on. But I think people need to look at this the way we hear about things from investment brokers. Past performance is no sign that the future performance is going to be that way. Just because we've been able to keep rates reasonable doesn't mean there's a guarantee of that going forward if we increase it to 40%. There's nothing locked in stone that it's going to happen that way. Those rate studies that have been done, and someone indicated they weren't quite finalized, capture results at a certain point in time, and I want to give you an example of a significant circumstance that we were able to take advantage of to bring in low-cost wind energy at 2.5 cents a kilowatt hour, which is almost unheard of. Well, how did we do that? We were able to use a production tax credit from the federal government, which is not a continuous permanent thing. You know, it becomes available, then it's not available. It comes and goes. We were able to buy wind turbines at fire sale prices during the Great Recession. We jumped on that opportunity and got very inexpensive wind turbines. Third, we built in North Dakota, and I've heard a lot about investment in Minnesota, and that's great, and we've got millions and billions of investment in Minnesota, but we found a superior wind source in North Dakota. We purchased an existing transmission line that would have cost us $500 million or more to build, but we got it for $80 million, and all those factors together allowed us to bring in 2.5 cent wind energy. Can I replicate that next year or 3 years from now? I don't know. I mean, it's probably unlikely that those circumstances will come together again. So to predict that we can bring wind in at that price in another couple of years is not realistic. I think that just about covers. Well, and I want to make one other comment about jobs. We were just hearing about jobs. And yes, some jobs come from energy supply. We have jobs in our system due to the energy that we're producing. But I think it's a tricky equation to equate jobs with energy supply, because the fact is that energy drives everything in our economy. They drive all kinds of jobs. And if we're going to up our energy prices, we could be negatively impacting other jobs that are not in the energy sector if those prices get too high. So I think it's not a simple equation as some make it out to be. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next testifier is Alan Muller, and I believe he's here to testify to the proposed A1 amendment by Representative Hornstein. So maybe we'll give you a minute, Representative Hornstein, to tell us what's in the A1 amendment, and then we'll have testimony.
Madam Chair, I'm willing to yield until Monday if that would be more convenient. There might be some people here who can't come back.
I think we're going to be able to make it through everybody by about 6 or 12:20 here. Not 6:20, 12:20. So, Representative Hornstein, to your amendment.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, members. We've heard a lot about renewable energy today, and so I have an A1 amendment that I'd like to move. Members, the reason I'm bringing this forward is that we've heard a lot about clean energy, green energy, renewable energy today, and I do not believe that garbage incineration should be included in our additional renewable energy standard. And the reason for that, Madam Chair and members, is that this form of generating energy, and I'll speak to the facility that I'm most familiar with, which is in downtown Minneapolis, is a major emitter of toxic air emissions. It relies, half of its fuel are easily and readily recyclable materials. Burning them is inefficient, and of course, if we were to recycle these materials instead of burn them, we'd get 7 times the energy savings by burning them. It's often it's often touted as an alternative to landfills, yet a third of the material ends up in a ash landfill, which is actually a more hazardous form of refuse than the actual garbage. But members, the real issue here is that we've talked about air emissions, greenhouse gases, recycling. This is also one of the major point sources of carbon emissions in the city of Minneapolis and in the state. And so this is just simply not on the level that solar and wind is. You cannot include garbage incineration for all the reasons I mentioned, as renewable energy, as clean energy, the same way that we're talking about wind and solar. I think it was a mistake that this was included in the original renewable energy standard. And the reason I'm bringing this forward is that, you know, this should not be included in this as well. So
thank you, Representative.
With that, Madam Chair, I'll yield to Mr. Mueller.
Is it Mueller or Mueller?
Mueller.
It's Mueller.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, remaining members of the committee, my name is Alan Mueller. I live in Red Wing. I'm here today on behalf of myself and also on behalf of the organization Minneapolis Neighbors for Clean Air. The need to reduce emissions from electricity generation is urgent in Minnesota, and this applies to both the climate-changing emissions that are heating up our planet and our state and the traditional health-damaging air pollutants that are killing and sickening Minnesotans. The problem that I want to present to you is that the notion of renewables is an extremely blunt, imprecise tool for doing that, because renewables, quote-unquote, include not only wind and solar, but include, as Representative Hornstein mentioned, garbage incineration, include landfill gas burning, include various undesirable, quote-unquote, biomass burners. And these were, as Representative Hornstein someone said, in my opinion, mistakenly included in the original definition of renewables. And the perspective I bring you here is that of someone who's looked at the permits, at the design, at the compliance history of various projects that have received preferences, quote-unquote, renewables in Minnesota. And possibly the most egregious example is the poultry litter burner in Benson that Representative Beard alluded to. This project is having a serious negative effect on the quality of life of people in that community. I was involved in a controversy over a 25-watt wood burner in Minneapolis, which was rejected. And this is a facility that was promoted to the community as green, as eco, as all these things. And my contribution to that controversy was to go through the documents and look at what the actual emissions would be. And I'll read a few of them to you here, just a few. 150 pounds of lead, 320,000 pounds a year of oxides of nitrogen, 61,000 pounds a year of hydrochloric acid, 14,000 pounds a year of formaldehyde, 13,000 pounds a year of benzene, and so on. And when people in the community had a look at those numbers and had a chance to think about it, of course, they decided they didn't want that in their neighborhood.
Can you wrap up?
But what we need to do here is not only include Representative Hornstein's amendment to exclude garbage incineration, but in general take a much more precise and focused approach to incenting new sources of electricity in Minnesota, to include those that are clean and to exclude those that are not clean. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. We have one witness on the other side of the issue, Trudy Richter. Representative Hornstein.
There was some confusion because Alan Mueller was, I think, wanted to testify to the broader bill. I did have somebody else that was going to specifically testify to my amendment. He testified to part of it, but of course disagrees apparently with part of it as well. So
okay, we'll take your testifier first.
Okay,
go ahead, Ms. Hubbard. If you can keep your testimony to 3 minutes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representatives. I'll be brief. I just wanted to say that I was here with Michael Noble years ago when the definition was created, and about the mistake that people are talking about that was made, including the definition. And the energy community, the folks that were wanting to create the renewable energy definition at that time, did not want to include garbage as a renewable, and it was a compromise situation. And looking back on it now many years, I can see why that happened, because at the time we didn't realize that we were going to have to spend $100 million to subsidize incineration. We didn't know the climate impacts of incineration. We didn't understand the job loss. We didn't know what recycling and composting could accomplish like we do today. So maybe it was a mistake then, but it's definitely a mistake now not to reconsider that definition. And this is a fair request, I think, from Representative Hornstein, because it doesn't say to go back and take away the renewable energy credits for those incinerators that already exist. It just says, let's just recognize that the policy of Minnesota has changed and that we understand what clean renewable energy is and what dirty energy is. And 80% of what is in the garbage is not renewable in the first place. And to get renewable energy that way is fractional amount of energy, and the energy lost by doing it that way and the pollution that created is devastating. So please consider seriously today the idea of going forward saying that no new incineration would be considered renewable, and that way it's fair, there's no more investments, and everybody's clear about what good clean energy is. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Trudy Richter.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hornstein. I am speaking against the A1 amendment. This is, as Representative Hornstein talked about, a jobs bill. I would like to point out the immediate impact this amendment would have. These are the counties that rely on resource recovery waste to energy as part of their management of waste in their communities. So you can see, if it's not where you live, it's where your colleagues, quick look, live. And it's a major input to the economy.
Do you want to hand that off?
I'm sorry.
The page can hold that for you.
Oh, okay. Currently, $8 million was granted by this legislature to the city of Perham and Otter Tail Power to increase their facility. That project would go away with the amendment offered. That serves barrel of fun potato chips, Tuffy's, dog food, and is the major economic generator for that community and that county. Pope Douglas recently increased their size. Although it wouldn't impact them, had this happened before, they would not be able to send energy to the hospital or 3M. It's important to understand that this is also directed at the Minneapolis facility, which is serving the Twins ballpark currently, district heating, and was always built with the capacity that they are trying to be able to use at this point in time. The permit was artificially capped. There are no changes needed for that facility to operate. And in Rochester, Minnesota, they just doubled the size of their facility. And they're serving over 25 businesses in Rochester as well as the college. The impact is significant. And so when we sat here many years ago, Fresh Energy was on one side of me and Isaac Walton League on the other, and we agreed that this should be renewable energy. It is much better than landfill gas, which has always been renewable and receives 22 and creates methane that's 22 times more potent as a greenhouse gas. Energy out of a waste-to-energy facility, out of one ton of garbage, is 10 times more energy than the same ton that goes into a landfill. So it's important to the economy of the state, to the economic of these communities, to taxpayers, and to the future. I'd also like to correct the record. We frequently attempt to do so. I've asked the page to hand out to show you that we, in fact, are a very clean power plant. The emissions here show over the years the regulation and the changes that we have succeeded in. Succeeded in reaching very low emission rates. And more importantly, I'd like to correct an earlier record here of the committees as it relates to greenhouse gases. That's, I have this for you, I'm sorry, since you're stuck up here. This speaks specifically to greenhouse gases and is a per unit of energy. You will note that we use the HERC facility, that's the downtown Minneapolis facility. You should look at the fossil portion of this graph. Per unit of energy is less than coal and oil. It is true that we report both, but the Minnesota, as well as the EPA, only focuses on the fossil portion of greenhouse gases. And finally, thank you for this opportunity to speak, and we also included a short information piece on transforming the state solid waste management vision into reality. All of these facilities represent top recycling in the state, and if you economically disadvantage them, more and more is going to go into landfills, which is always the cheapest option, and this state has already paid $350 million to clean up those landfills. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Allen has a question.
Madam Chair, just a statement. I mean, at the end of the testifier stated that it's about being economically disadvantaged, and that I think that's a valid argument. But this amendment is burning of trash. It's not intended to ban it. It's just whether or not it's going to be classified as a renewable energy source. And I think at best, I mean, that the EPA says that, you know, 20% of it is renewable. The rest of it can be recycled. So I think, you know, the issue is the economics of it, but that we can, that our resource, that we should shift away from burning trash to recycling. I mean, that's simple.
Thank you, Representative Allen. Our next testifier is Peter Nelson from the Center for the American Experiment. And on deck is Sarah Nichols from the Minnesota Youth Environmental Network. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Peter Nelson. I'm the Director of Public Policy for Center of the American Experiment. We're an organization that develops and advances public policies to promote prosperity for Minnesota. And on energy policy, we believe that affordable and competitive energy rates are vital to Minnesota's ability to compete both nationally and across the globe. We believe that this bill would diminish our ability to compete. And I think we've already heard the fact that, you know, if this bill wasn't going to increase energy rates, then why do you need a mandate? So I think it's very clear that this is going to increase energy rates. And we've already heard from Great River Energy today that they have capacity, they have their capacity needs taken care of through 2030. So anything new for them is going to be an extra cost. And so I think it's very clear that it's going to add an extra cost. And I'll take you to my second point. And my second point is that 2 years ago I reviewed all of our renewable energy standards, all of our green energy policies. And I came up with this report, which I'll hand out to you after my testimony here. And in that report, I basically came to the conclusion that we don't really need a renewable energy standard. And I also basically came to the conclusion that we don't need our conservation improvement program mandates as well. And the reason I mentioned the conservation improvement program is because what I recommended back then in regards to our energy efficiency programs is that instead of having a mandate, we should instead move that back to the integrated resource planning process. And that was the most appropriate place because that took care of some of the problems that we have with the SIP program because it's not as flexible as it could be. And the reason I mention that is because I think a lot of those same reasons would suggest that our renewable energy standard should also be moved to the integrated resource planning process. And we've already heard today about the flexibility issues that we're experiencing. And so I would encourage us to look at doing that instead of advancing this mandate, because even in our integrated resource planning process, we actually do account for the cost of carbon. State law requires that long-range planning to estimate whether, you know, to include an estimation of the expected cost of carbon regulations. And that does factor in a lot of issues that would promote renewable energy just through that process alone. Finally, I want to take a moment and just take a note on jobs. I did some back-the-envelope analysis last night just to take a look at jobs and see what a rate increase. We know there's going to be a rate increase. We don't exactly know what it'll be. But I just kind of thought, okay, what would a half-cent increase look like to our education system? And looking at our state website for education, we have 165 million square feet of school in the state. And looking at the Department of Energy's website, we have about 8.2 kilowatt hours per square feet. So the cost of our energy system for our schools at current commercial rates equals about $117 million. If we increase just a half cent on our schools, that equals $6.8 million. Now, we heard earlier today that a solar mandate of 10% might increase rates by 40%. A 40% increase would be $47 million on our schools. Now, looking at that number in regards to teachers, that's about 800 teachers, and that's just one sector of the economy. So I really think the jobs issue, this really would curtail jobs in Minnesota. Now, with that, I will conclude my testimony, and thank you for your time.
Sarah Nichols from the Minnesota Youth Environmental Network. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for hearing my testimony. My name is Sarah Nichols. I'm 19 years old, and I'm a freshman at McAllister College. And I'm here today in two capacities. One, as an individual who is alarmed with the impacts of climate change, and as a representative of the next generation, most specifically the Minnesota Youth Environmental Network. So the young people around the state are committing themselves to studying the effects of climate change, and they're doing this in college, like me. Environmental studies is one of the most popular majors at McAllister. But more so, beyond the classroom, students and young people are getting involved in their communities and really promoting what clean energy means to them. And one of the best examples I can provide is students from around the state came to the Capitol a few weeks ago to lobby their state senators and representatives to promote renewable energy, specifically this bill. And I think that really shows that renewable energy isn't just a simple request, it's a prerequisite for the economy, for the next generation of the workforce that is really embedding themselves into renewable energy as a viable aspect of this state's economy. And furthermore, I want to keep this brief because I have class to get to, but there's been a lot of talk today about costs, and I ask the opponents as well to this bill as well as the committee to consider those costs, but as well as the long-term costs of climate change that will have on my generation and generations to come. And I think that is the bottom line and fundamental argument that should be considered when debating this bill and other energy standards. So thank you.
Thank you. Doug Fries. Welcome to the committee. If you can, when you get down there, state your name and go ahead and proceed.
My name is Doug Fries, and I'm a farmer in Wisconsin. And I
oh no, you're from Wisconsin?
Yeah, bad news. But
we'll let you talk anyway.
My problem with all this thing is I can't believe it's still going on. I've been fighting this thing for 9 years, and it's just a debacle to us guys in Wisconsin, who had done a lot of research before they ever got going big time, I guess. Over in my area, they come to my farm, wanted to build them. I thought it was my golden goose. So then I get to doing a little research, and I find out the golden goose laid a big egg. This stuff isn't worth a toot. It isn't going to help us on this energy problem. It's just not in wind. If you go to the energy analysts like I did my own research, no internet, none of that. I went to the energy analyst in West Virginia, Office of Budget and Management, Glenn Schlede, also an energy analyst out of California, Tom Tanton on the California Energy Board, 35 years and ahead of it. They both laughed at us. They said it's just a joke. It's all money. It doesn't have a thing to do with power because you're not producing enough power. Go back to real energy, coal, oil, anything but wind and solar. Wind is just horrible, just on the money side. Then you get to the health and safety. The health and safety here would be the Shirley research on low frequency ultrasound. What it does is create a real problem for people like seasickness. And this was done in December 13th. This is really a big time, really something that people need to pay attention to. There's people moved out of their houses. I've spent years on this thing. It's just sad. It is absolutely sad. I know where the houses are that are bulldozed in Kewaunee County. I know where the guys are that are moved out. I know where the guys are that have had heart attacks fighting this, trying to live with it. I sell chemicals as well as farm. I've got customers that call me in, buy chemicals, and then they say, oh, I can't stand it tonight. I go, what's going on? Well, one of them in particular said, I can't stand the noise. It's driving us nuts. I said, what is it? He goes, it's two wind turbines that they built on the other side of my farm. He said, they're not from us. We're dairy farmers. We're trying to survive this. When is someone going to stand up for the real people living with this crap? It's horrible. It's about money.
Can you wrap up?
It's nothing more than money. Green energy is money. I would like to submit the Shirley Wind study and the McPherson study, because I think they're really pertinent to people living anywhere or going to live anywhere close to a wind turbine.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Ron Rastley?
Good morning, Madam Chairman. First of all, my name is Ron Rasley. I'm with legal counsel with Blattner Energy, and I can beat the three-minute time limit today.
Great.
So. We are the largest constructor of wind farms in the United States. We've built 8 of the 10 largest wind farms in the United States. None of them are located here in Minnesota. The reason for that is a lot of the developers have gone to other states. They either have more mandates or they have other incentives to drive the economic engines of those states. And what I will tell you is that when we do work in Minnesota, we use a number of subcontractors, suppliers. They're all based here in Minnesota. We're based in Avon, Minnesota, which is in Stearns County, Minnesota. So we are in rural Minnesota. So we have a lot of employees that are based here in Minnesota. A lot of our subs and suppliers are based here in Minnesota. And that economic effect is a tremendous amount. So with that, I would conclude our testimony.
Thank you very much. And I don't know if Rick Evans from Excel wanted to pass or not pass. He passes. Representative Hornstein, I am told by staff you need to withdraw the amendment since we're not voting on it. To keep our records clean. So can you withdraw your amendment, please?
Yes, what would be the process for considering the
Just
amendment?
Just say I withdraw my motion.
No, but Madam Chair, in terms of...
Just like we do on the floor. I guess, so just withdraw your amendment because we're not voting on anything today.
Okay. So we'll discuss this when we're dealing
You could say you temporarily withdraw your motion.
Yeah, I'll temporarily withdraw my motion.
Al Mathewitz wouldn't like that because that's not, you know, proper, okay. But let's do that.
We'll lay it over for future discussion, I guess.
There we go.
Okay.
Representative Hornstein withdraws his motion. Please sum up.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just have very quick summary comments. And I wanted to thank you specifically for running a great hearing and for the members and for the public on both sides. This was really a great day for debate and discussion about energy policy. So I want to thank everybody for coming. I'm going to just make a couple of quick summary points, Madam Chair. First, just to review what I said going back full circle to the beginning. Now is the time for us to add to the success of our legislative accomplishment in 2007, and we heard testimony as to why. I believe implementation of our current law is going very well. 11 out of 13 utilities report no significant cost impacts in implementing the current RES. We heard a lot about cost. I want that to be on the record. 11 of 13, no significant cost. We heard some testimony that mentioned putting the cart before the horse. And it needing additional study. But we did those studies in 2006 and 2007, and the state and region have learned a lot about wind integration. We have 17 years, I mentioned, to make sure we get this right, and that's a long time. I think it's quite conservative. And then the 40% by 2030 barely moves the meter at all with MISO. And so that's also an important point to mention. And then finally, with regards to the amendment, I just wanted everyone to be clear, this is prospective. It would not affect all of these plants that Ms. Richter talked about. And it does relate to the HERC expansion. That was correct. That's the only one I know of that's going to be expanded or built that's on the docket. And as was mentioned, even the HERC data that was pointed out, this is a significant source of greenhouse gas emissions on par with other fossil fuels. And for that reason, I will hope that we can consider our amendment when we discuss this bill further. And with that, Madam Chair, I am finished. And again, thanks to you and thanks to the committee for all the time you set aside for this very, very important issue.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. And thank you very much to all the members of the public who traveled here to participate in the process. We really value your input. And even though we wish we could get everybody as much time as they wanted, that wouldn't be practical or feasible. So please continue to provide your input by email, and we'll make sure that your comments get distributed to the members of the committee. And I hope everybody has a safe drive home. With that, members, we are adjourned.